Hello and welcome to episode 37 of Shockwaves. 37.
Wow.
I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane. Sup?
Hey, man. Hey, that 37 man. Cheapens it because I feel like we've been on the air for like 180 episodes.
Yeah, it's been a lot longer.
It feels like it.
Yeah. Back this week is Rebecca McKendry.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. Not so bad. Not so bad.
I missed you guys last week.
We missed you as well. There is a definite hole left in this podcast when
there's
Becca's
too much
gone.
Testosterone. Yeah. Gone.
I felt really weird. It was just like too much.
Facebook, I'm sure it's just like sweaty and hair, and that's like what was there when
notice
I
noticed my silence.
Too many dudes.
I have nothing to say.
Elric is not defending this. And last but not least, of course, is Ryan Turek. What's up?
How are you doing?
Good, man. Good.
How's your week?
Week is okay so far.
How's everybody's week?
It's been hectic.
Just great, Ryan.
I'm going to be honest, Ryan. Let's talk about my week.
Do you really want to know?
You do not give a shit about it.
Seriously? Tell us about your kids.
Except the three of us got CXX last night. We'll talk about that later, but that was fun.
Yeah. We
record these on, you know, I mean, like the episode drops on Friday. We record this on hump day. You know, it's like we're halfway through the week.
Where are you at? This is what happened. So as we mentioned last week, we are now pulling in sponsors, a lot of people that we are excited about because it's mostly companies that we buy from.
Yeah.
So take it away, Becca. Who's sponsoring this week's show?
This week is sponsored by our friends at Fright Rags Horror T-Shirts.
Love it.
Yeah.
They're always clothing me.
I love them. They are always focused on creating original artwork commissioned from only the top artists and printing on super soft ring spun cotton t-shirts. They always have amazing licensed properties, and their product line covers more than shirts. It includes socks, lounge pants, even horror masks.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, they are currently launching a new line of Wax Packs trading cards and starting with the Reanimator.
Ryan is wearing
Fright Rags socks right now. And Elric has a Fright Rags shirt on right now.
Maybe.
Boom.
Now, here's the cool thing, guys. For Shockwaves listeners, they are giving you guys a discount for all Shockwaves listeners.
What?
If you go to the Fright Rags, I'm using it. Yeah, I know. I'm going to use it too.
I'm leaving the show right now to go use that code.
If you go to the Fright Rags website right now, www.frightrags.com, and enter the code SHOCKWAVES10 at checkout, you'll get an extra 10% off all of your orders. The code is good through 3/31, March 31st. Nice. So definitely go take care of it now and get your Fright Rags stuff.
It's actually fright-rags.com. I think there's a dash in between Fright Rags.
Yes. Fright-rags.
So and you can also find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But just head to the site, get an awesome horror t-shirt and put in the code SHOCKWAVES10 and get your 10% off.
I just want to say they have great customer service.
Oh my God. Ben is amazing.
Their whole team is great. Yeah. I had a little snafu with an order once and they were like, don't worry about it. We're going to ship it out to you. We'll send you a new pair.
No problem.
Like, fantastic. And they're very active on Twitter, which is great. Fright Rags,
you know,
completely
cool?
Indoors.
They have kids shirts. My kids have like a whole line of Fright Rags shirts.
Mine's got the horror sticker lounge pants.
Oh, that's awesome.
So even if you don't have kids, buy some of those kids shirts.
Oh, you have kids. You need to buy them Fright Rags shirts. I will say I'm really excited because we just did a quick live feed and we were talking about Valentine's Day movies to watch, Valentine's horror. And Fright Rags actually just launched a whole series of My Bloody Valentine shirts, as well as a collector pack. And also
a Valentine shirt.
Yes. Well, that's Cavity Colors did that one. Regular Valentine is Cavity Colors.
Oh, my God. My Instagram feed is just filled with horror t-shirts galore.
That's right. Yeah. But I know me and Ryan are big fans of the baseball tees.
Yes.
So I might have to get it. What is it about Harry Warden that we're just like, yes, I like that face. I want that on a shirt.
Well, because it's so anonymous. You know? It's just like, the gas mask thing is something that I see in independent horror cinema all the time and in other, you know, avenues. And I'm like, that's not a striking image to me. It's not scary. Who does that? But for Harry Warden, it makes sense and it's creepy.
Yeah,
because they had an actual mine. It really helped that movie.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
And Moose Beer. I love the Moose Beer label. Yes. Every beer can. Yeah. Good stuff.
All right, so we've got so much stuff to talk about before we get our guests on here. Why don't we start at TV? Because I know all of us have at least started Santa Clarita Diet, and it's something that everybody's talking about.
Where are you all at it?
I finished it.
You finished
episode three.
episodes I've watched.
Yeah.
You three. I'm like four. So.
Oh, my God. I'm the only loser that finished it. I had all that time on my hands. And I finished The People versus O.J. Simpson as well.
Jesus.
Wow. Notice our silence.
Well, I don't have kids and significant others like all you guys do.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what to expect from the show because we did run a trailer and a featurette. And I just didn't know, you know, I'm tired of the zombie genre, quite frankly. It's very rare that anything new gets done with it. And especially now zombie comedies, where there's been so many like post Shaun of the Dead that are not nearly as good. So I didn't really know what to expect from this show, but I watched the pilot and me and my roommate laughed our asses off. And I thought it was really good. And the gore just kind of took me off guard. So I was like, all right, this is right up my alley.
Yeah, I really wasn't expecting it because I got to be honest, like the trailers were not doing much for me. Like I was watching them and I was like, I'm intrigued. I'll probably watch an episode and then, you know, stop. But the first episode, I absolutely loved it. And I admittedly am not usually a Drew Barrymore fan. A lot of her projects I've not been too into. But this one, I was like, I was completely there with. I love it.
She's such a fine thespian. Everything's so meticulous in this performance. It's so rigid,
very
rigorous.
Nuanced.
Sure.
No,
very
nuanced. I was surprised by the tone being so over the top. I wasn't expecting it to be as big as it was, especially in the performances. I mean, it's huge.
It's
bigger than Weeds, big. That's right. But, you know, it's endearing, and I'm on the fence. By episode three, I'm like, I like this. It's light enough to keep watching. I'm definitely not in love with it yet. I live where it's set, which is fun, and it's accurate geographically, so that's been kind of – I know we –
It is not a convincing
representation
to move there. Like we're watching,
because
Dave and I keep considering Santa Clarita, and we're watching it in the first episode where he's like freaking out over the toaster, and all of his neighbors are kind of
that's called marriage,
catty,
not Santa
and
Clarita.
I was like,
that's just
this
the banality
is not
of
selling
marriage.
Me on nice. Santa Clarita.
But you know, I actually think the comic timing is fun, and you know, it's goofy. I have no idea where it's going to go and if it could last much.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
I'll talk about that, but I know Ryan is got a different opinion.
I'm on the lower end of the spectrum here. I mean, like I the funny thing is I'll keep watching it, but it's the tonal shifts that throw me off. You know, I didn't think it was going to be so kind of slapstick, over the top, funny. So it had me begging a bunch of questions, like, what is she? What's going on? Really, the husband is going to jive with this so quickly?
Yeah.
Okay, what's his whole motivation behind it? It was like question after question after question. It wasn't getting answered because they were just like spooling into the next like kind of Drew Barrymore moment where she's like, I'm really hungry. And it's like, ah, ha, ha. You might as well throw a laugh track on this thing. You know?
No, it's very sitcom.
I am intrigued if they ever kind of circle back and explain exactly what's going on. Because, I mean, granted, I'm only on episode three.
Yeah, don't tell us, Rob, but are there more answers in the season?
No.
Okay. No. Right,
and that's wow. Here's the thing. Ryan posted online that he thought that Timothy O'Fallon was completely miscast.
I did not. I texted you guys that.
Oh, you texted it.
Yes.
Sorry.
But now that it's out.
But the point I strongly disagree with you. And
no,
I think
I'm never going to work with that fucking Blumhouse again.
No, Timothy Olyphant, I'll say this. I'm being very honest. You know, I think he's a great actor. Obviously, you know, I'm repping Scream 2. I think he was great in that. And I've always loved him on Justified and all that other stuff. But I think that – and Deadwood. But, you know, for something that's so madcap, I just think it's the timing, the comedic timing. It takes precision, and I don't know if he's all the way there. So,
you know
what,
though,
it
takes a good partner to be I wonder if he's hitting a tennis ball to a empty seat at
times.
Well,
that's so funny. I mean, that's the thing about comedies, because you think the timing's off, and I think his timing, his delivery is what makes it so funny
for
me.
Yeah, I think that he is what's selling it for me, because, I mean – Drew is very charming in it,
yeah,
she definitely
charming.
Has this charm to her. But I think that what's selling the comedic timing and the humor is Timothy in this one.
I think it's a nice holiday for him. Yeah. You know, it's like a nice break from being intense. No,
you know what? You know who gets mad props is the daughter.
Yeah,
she's right.
The actress that plays the daughter
very
is
naturalistic.
Yeah,
and
very,
then the next door neighbor who is kind of like the daughter's love interest or vice versa, he's really hilarious and he's got a lot of fun moments in it. The only thing I'll say, because obviously I'm the only one that finished it, I know a lot of our listeners probably did too, is – I liked it a lot. I really loved it. I thought it was really funny. They lost me with one thing around episode 7. And really, this goes into what Ryan was saying about the tone of it, where I think sometimes they shift in a little too dark of a direction, where they make a character do something that I think is a little too dark and unredeemable. But then it's like, is this not?
They do that from the get-go.
It's
so weird.
But I kind of go with it in terms of like, oh, well, it's just a goofy comedy. But there's one thing in particular.
Like it actually breaks the barrier up.
Yeah,
the
one
weird,
thing I was like, I don't know if I agree with that. Yeah. And then the next episode, they try to rectify it by being like, well, you know, right. basically without spoiling it, somebody kills somebody that I thought was unexpected. And I was like, you kind of lost me there. Mm. And like, but he was a bad guy. Like they pull the Dexter thing where they sure. constantly say the people that they're, you know, taking, you know, killing and eating are bad people. And I'm kind of like, you can't have it both ways. And
it's hard to maintain stakes when everything's so big.
Yeah. But they, I mean, they do a lot of great twists and fun turns that I didn't expect at all. The ending, quite frankly, because it's only 10 episodes, they're only like 25 minutes long each. I was really disappointed because they do not, they pretty much leave it so, not a cliffhanger, but they pretty much leave it so wide open for another season rather than resolving sure. anything. Yeah. That's really frustrating.
It's Netflix. Like, it's Netflix, baby. They know they got a secure future.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't know. I would have liked some sort of closure.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, kind of talking about the Dexter of it all too, because that's what I was kind of a little bit disappointed about. It was like, oh, okay, we're going to go onto that old trope. You know, right. I get that. It's really hard to do a Dexter after Dexter did it so well, right. you know. I do want to give out a shout out to Richard T. Jones, who plays the neighbor in it. You may remember him from Event Horizon.
Oh, snap.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Nice. I was like, oh, yes. A little Event Horizon represented
Nathan
in
Fillion
here.
Was hilarious.
Fillion was good, too. Yeah. He's spoiler that he's in it.
It's the first episode. He's in like the first 10 minutes.
He becomes a major character in the show.
And let's see. Other TV stuff. I'm only going to – this isn't really horror, but I want to mention it, is I've seen the first two episodes of Riverdale.
I'm dying to see it.
Oh, my God. It looks so sleazy.
You know what's funny is we have thrown around the term guilty pleasure and how we don't believe in it because it's like you shouldn't feel guilty about anything. This show is the epitome of guilty pleasure. I can't believe I shouldn't like it, but I do, because it is totally a Twin Peaks ripoff meets like Melrose Place.
But on the CW.
But on the CW.
But in the world of Archie.
Brilliant.
In the world of Archie.
That's what it is, yeah.
And I don't understand why the Archie, like, because Archie got a new kind of this big revival when they did Afterlife with Archie, yeah. where mm-hmm. they put in the center of a zombie apocalypse. I don't know why perverting Archie is like such an interesting thing, but it's really good so far. I mean, it's totally a Twin Peaks ripoff. It revolves around this little town and a murder. Yeah. So it's totally that. Tonally, it's so catty, and yet somehow I find it thoroughly entertaining. Luke Perry from 90210 as Archie's dad is amazing.
That's
casting.
That's kind of brilliant.
Perfect. And I'm really digging it. I mean, we already have Josie and the Pussycats, and there's rumors that Sabrina the Teenage Witch is going to show up.
That's one that's really popular.
Oh, my gosh. Behind that, yeah. I'm totally watching this tonight.
It's pretty fun. I like it. I'm curious what you guys think of that one. So that's TV.
I caught Powerless. Did you guys see that one yet?
No, and I'm dying to.
No.
I got to say, it's over the top, like to the degree that like Pushing Daisies was over the top, where everything's brightly colored and very much caricatures. I'm not sure if I'm enjoying it or not yet. Yeah. I'm anxious to see where it's going. I'm definitely going to keep watching. But it's the DC universe, but it's about the people in the DC universe who don't have any powers. And they're definitely kind of using the, I'll call them the D-grade DC superheroes, like the Jack-O-Lantern guy was in the first one. Oh. And while I'm watching it, I was like, is that a real superhero? And I had to Google it.
It's the people that have to clean up after them.
Yeah.
Like after all the big battles, like what happens next?
Oh, so DC beat Marvel to the punch on that TV show. It's Marvel had something like that too.
Yeah. Yes, it's the lower level regular people, how they deal with the aftermath of superheroes.
Because like in the first episode, they talk about how the number one cause of office injury is Superman bursting through your office window and things like that.
That's
funny. So it's fun. But the delivery, it's very 1950s over the top caricature. So I don't know how sustainable that's going to be for an audience, but the first episode was really amusing. So I'm anxious to see where it goes.
Nice.
All righty.
Nice.
Movies.
Yeah. I just want to say, guys, and I apologize in advance if I'm coughing my way through this. I think I got Steve Johnson's Captain Trips.
I
wasn't here for that, but you left his mic behind.
Oh, that's right.
I think I got his mic.
That's right. We talked about giving it to
him. Oh, Turek got the mic.
Thanks a lot, guys.
The death mic.
I got the Steve Johnson virus.
I forgot Turek listens.
Yes.
Damn!
Yes.
When I left that insult at the end.
All right, so movies. Let's Rings, man. Rings came out. We had the director on last week. Ryan and I saw it. Did anyone else see it? Did you guys see it? I know a lot of our listeners did. Or is this just me and Ryan talking about it?
I think that's just you and Ryan.
I didn't have a desire to see it. And I mean, nothing to do with our guests because that was a fun talking. But even before that, it's like I just wasn't feeling the pull to see this movie. It wasn't something I was feeling like I needed in my
life. Right. Okay, Ryan, I'm going to start us off and you could join me.
Yeah.
So here's what I'll have to say. I want to preface this with two things. One, I actually I enjoyed tremendously talking to the director last week and seeing what he wanted to do with that film. So this is no play on him. When it comes to these type of movies, and I'm going to make a reference in a minute, there's a lot of voices and hands in it. And there was one specific thing that I
literally turned, lots of voices.
Literally. And there was one thing in particular that really bothered me that I turned to you and called out when it happened. And I'll mention in a minute. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I've said this last week and several times, the American versions of these Japanese movies, for the most part, don't work for me anyways. So I already had that going in, and I just watched Sadako versus Kayako, which I thought was just so much fun.
It's so fun. Yeah.
So much fun. And this is not. This is the complete opposite of fun. It is just – I don't even understand the point of it. When Sadako has less screen time in Your Ring sequel than the prank videos that are going around, there's a problem.
She doesn't have much screen time?
She's barely in it. This is three movies in.
That should be the prime focus because that's what everybody wants. I mean, the people who do want an American sequel to the Ring franchise are there because they love Sadako.
But who are those people?
Samara in this. You are correct.
Thank you.
Well, you know what? Again, is this maybe the same thing as Blair Witch where a lot of people don't remember who – you know, Samara is.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been, what, 12 years?
Yeah.
12 years since the very first one. And it takes a little bit. And, you know, it was interesting, too, is because you have to re-educate the public into what the ring is and who Samara is. And then you also have to kind of, like, educate the audience in terms of going, this is a sequel. It's not a reboot, you know. And it took a lot of – you could tell it was an uphill battle from the start creatively, on a advertising level, in every facet, you know.
Yes.
And I feel like one of the biggest drag to me was that it was boring. It felt like it was very sluggish.
Yeah, there's one or two solid ideas.
There's some good ideas. Well, what was funny is that –
buried in a really boring, long movie.
Well, what's funny is that doesn't Sadako versus Kayako and in Rings share a very similar opening, which is they discover a VCR at like a yard sale or something
but
like that?
But
in Sadako versus Kayako, it was a thrift mart.
It's similar, but they do it in a way that's just like, you know, because they open with the plane.
Comparatively speaking, it's not as clever. Sadako versus Kayako, they're like, what is a VCR? Like, what is this? And then they kind of go into explaining it. And it's like, oh, that's pretty funny.
That was so great because the girls, it's these two teenage girls who find the tape and therefore have to go buy it. And there's this big deal about how they don't even know how to work it.
Right.
Never seen
it's
it.
Funny.
Like, it's very
Rings,
fun.
It's just a kind of, I mean, the characters who are picking it up are older.
So he knows what it is. And it's just, you know what it is? I don't need a reintroduction. I mean, they reintroduced the Ring mythology in Sadako versus Kayako very quickly and swiftly in a way that was interesting.
And it was set up as an urban legend, like, oh, I heard this like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
This takes way too long for that because the interesting idea is probably at the end of the first act where now there's a whole thing going on at this college where there's a professor that found the ring tape and is doing an experiment by making all these kids watch it and then making them pass it. And that's the coolest thing. And it's only for that brief moment.
You're
like, well, no, that's your opening your movie. And that's the movie I want to see because now that's interesting. And instead it falls back into the same like, all right, now that we've done that, let's go back to the origin of
let's go back and
who her
do
parents
another procedural
are for an hour and not have her in it.
Now, have you guys seen any of the Ring sequels, the Japanese ones? Some of them aren't that bad.
No, they're pretty good. I like Ringo 2.
Yeah, Ringo 2. There was a number of them that I was like, this is a pretty solid film. I'm curious. I mean, and granted, I tend to be against international remakes, but if they were looking for something, why they didn't turn to that direction and say, hey, these are pretty decent.
I honestly feel like it's diminishing returns on both Japanese soil and American soil in terms of the Ring franchise.
Hence the Versus movie.
And they're like cultural differences. We've talked about that before, but I feel like it follows. I think part of the popularity of It Follows is because it was kind of the American Rings.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a version because it's about sex and it's about being a teenager, and those are tropes of American 80s culture versus being a slow-moving Japanese thing with long hair. It's a very different cultural
thing.
That's
a very valid point. And again, the last thing I'll admit, which I teased it before, is there was a moment where a blind character – mild spoiler – a blind character in this movie turns out to be evil – and hits all the lights off in his house to chase the girl around. And I just looked at Ryan and was like, man, Don't Breathe did really well that one weekend when they were shooting this, huh? Because there's the Don't Breathe sequence. So I'm really bummed because I would have liked a great, you know, continuation of it. But again, I'm more into the Japanese ones anyway. So,
yeah.
You know, but anyways, so that was our movie.
Why don't we talk about a great movie?
Yes, go.
I don't recall this movie very well at all. You all know I'm a huge fan of Part 3, but I watched Poltergeist Part 2, the Scream Factory release. I had not seen it since I was a kid. My only memory of this film was that it had some weird Manitou vibe to it with the Native American stuff, and I remembered Kane in a weird temple underground, like, you know.
It's like a cave.
The cave, yeah. Under the house. But I had no memory. Like, I thought I would. I was expecting it to feel familiar. It felt so fresh and new to me that I kind of loved it. I don't love it on the level of 3, but here's the crazy thing that I just realized. This might be now my favorite trilogy because all 3 movies are fun. Like, right. The first one's actually a great movie. The second one's fun, but way uneven. And the third one to me is like just an effects bonanza.
It is.
And a friend of ours posted today, Brian Collins, shared it. Somebody took the endings of both the endings of Part 3, the ending that they reshot where no one wanted to reshoot it without Carol Ann, and the original ending they did shoot, and he's married them and rescored it and recolor it so as you get the best possible closure ending.
Because the original ending on the Poltergeist 3 disc is actually really good. Like, not great, but it's better than what they put in there.
Yeah, because what they did is just so bleak because it's a little girl with her head away from camera.
And you can't see her.
But the cool thing about it, I mean, look, Steve Johnson was just here. The thing where he spews out this creature is one of those...
Tequila worm.
It's such a bonkers moment. But in this movie, the one thing about it, like about halfway through, I just remember I was watching with Dick and I was like, oh, there's no poltergeist in this movie. And I realized it's the Insidious 2. It has more in common with Insidious 2 than the poltergeist.
Yeah.
It's like a demon movie. It's much more about a demon coming back. And there's a scene, there's two sequences. The ending's pretty, you know, not very great. But there's two sequences that are genuinely
scary. When
they
go into the further?
Exactly.
The other side? Is like, the cave stuff in that was freaky because everybody's starving.
Cave performance.
The other side. I mean, come on. They're all just like floating around in this like fucking painted
background. That's really bad.
That's terrible.
Really
but everything before that.
But there's a scene where Kane comes to the door and he's trying to convince the dad.
Yeah.
And when he's behind the screen, they're at first looking face to face, and it's not scary at all. Mm-hmm. And the scene's just going. And then he puts the screen door between them, and there's these shots of Kane behind a screen cover, and there's something about it that I actually was getting chills. And I was like, "Fuck, man, I can't remember the last time I saw a horror scene where an adult character, like an adult man, is being menaced by something that's actually scary." Because it's hard to do that on screen. And then the other sequence when he becomes kind of like Insidious 2, when the dad becomes possessed.
Yeah. All right,
it's one of my favorite performances in that little section. Where he's channeling Kane, he does a fucking great job in that. Yeah. So I had a lot of fun with it. It's, you know, it's still not on the level of the others, but it was kind of nice to realize these three films together could actually hold up pretty well as a trilogy compared to most horror film trilogies when I think about it, you know, as bonkers as it is. But there are so many little things I kept noting down that got me excited, like, oh my God, like you just forget all this shit when you haven't seen it for a long time.
Yeah. Becca?
Yeah, I shot a film.
How'd that go?
That was really good. It was fun. Elric came. He was an extra for a day.
Right on.
Well, not a day. I think I had you on.
No, it was like an hour and a half. It was a nice big coat I got to wear.
Yeah, it was good.
Good fun.
So, so I'll have details on that soon, hopefully.
Nice.
But anyways, I didn't get to watch as much as usual, but I did watch one movie because the night before we were shooting, I needed to just kind of chill out. And I am doing an academic panel on nun films. As you guys know, of course I am. Of course I am. So I rewatched 1975 Satanico Pandemonium as I stumble over it. Satanico Pandemonium.
Oh, yeah, we were all rewatching it.
Guys totally just rewatched it, like right beforehand. But most people know the phrase Satanico Pandemonium from Dusk Till Dawn because that's what Quentin and Robert Rodriguez named Salma Hayek's character. But it comes from a 1975 Mexican nun film, which is, I got to say, probably my favorite of the nun films, which is why I rewatched it. I highly recommend it to you guys. It's definitely,
putting that on my list of things to watch.
It's fascinating. It is. Absolutely,
or you could just bring it in.
Bring it in. I do own it. It is directed by Gilberto Martinez Solares, and it was actually inspired by Ken Russell's The Devils, and so it's like a Mexican version of Ken Russell's The Devils, and it's got a lot of social consciousness to us, which you usually see in nun films. Like, most of the nun films are about women being oppressed and things like this, but it's also got a big racist overtone, and The Devil's in it. He shows up, so it's kind of fun. It's definitely one of my faves. Absolutely beautifully shot. It's gorgeous.
Nice.
All righty. Ryan.
I borrowed Rob G's copy of Gingersnaps 2 Unleashed because it has been a while since I've revisited the Gingersnaps trilogy.
Did you watch one again first recently?
No. I watched one when the Blu-ray came out, which was a little while ago.
Which there's an interview with me on.
Yes, there is. Yeah. A lot of familiar female faces in that, on the extras. Gingersnaps 2, if you guys recall, came out in 2004. Brett Sullivan directed, and I believe Brett was an editor on the first one, or he had something to do with the first one. Mm-hmm. And it was a Canadian production. Lionsgate got involved. I saw like Peter Block's name as an EP on it. It takes place a few years after the original. Bridget, who is one of our main characters in the first one, after the death of her sister, spoiler alert, you know, you have to have seen the first one, come on, is now kind of holding back her kind of beastly ways with a cocktail of injecting monk's hood from the first one into her arm. And, you know, she's kind of coming across like a junkie. She's more or less just like a gypsy moving from place to place. And
what
we discover.
What does the monk's hood do? Because I've never seen part two.
Oh, well, it kind of like holds back the lycanthropy.
Oh,
it kind of
okay.
holds back the virus
like
a little
Wolf
bit.
Spain or
But she's got to keep injecting it. So she looks like full on junkie mode. She's like, she's emaciated. She's got whole track marks in her arm. But she's constantly on the run. And what you discover is she's on the run because there is another werewolf out there and it has things in mind for her. Mm-hmm. And so while she's on the run, she gets taken into a hospital and she's put under care there. And of course, they all think she's a junkie, but she's like, no, I stress. I have something terrible inside me and something terrible is out after me. And she meets up with a little girl named Ghost, who is played by Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black, the lead from Orphan Black. And she's this warped little girl who is watching over her grandmother at the hospital while she's in the burn intensive care unit. And so they strike up a friendship. Bridget gets out of the hospital, and then some more insane shit goes down. Now, the movie, because I remember seeing it in 2004, and I was like, wow, that's how you do a sequel. Like, that's how you really push the series forward. Catherine Isabel takes a co-starring role in it. She kind of plays the, you know, Jack to, you know, to the David in American Werewolf in London. She plays kind of like this ghost figure who talks to Bridget throughout the film, is kind of like the moral compass of, you know, just succumb to the lycanthropy. You can't stop this. You got to go just, you know, fulfill your inhibitions, your sexual inhibitions. And it's incredibly dark. It's not as thematically poignant as the first film, but it has some interesting things. It's really, it's really bleak. It's a bleak, dark, ugly-looking movie. But I love the kind. I love that. Love that about the sequel. And the third act is clever, but and it's super warped. But it's not emotionally satisfying because they don't necessarily close up the sisterly relationship that really made the first film pop.
Yeah, first one's a great movie,
and and it, you know, that worked so well, and then they. And Bridget kind of gets like shafted in this one, you know. It's not it's not satisfying to the character that we love so much. So it's an interesting sequel to check out, just because Gingersnaps was such a great, like I still think it's one of the great werewolf films of the last 20 years.
Yeah. And original,
and great
original.
Teen horror, like
great
teen centric horror.
Exactly, yeah, and very and definitively Canadian.
Yeah,
you know? And this was too. And
has the director of the original gone on to much in the last few years?
TV. Tons of TV. In fact, I think he created a show up in Canada or something like that. Yeah. But if you're a fan of Gingersnaps, I recommend checking out Gingersnaps 2 Unleashed just to see where they carried that on. The third one was a period film, but I couldn't wrap my head around that.
Yeah, that's the one that doesn't work. I think they did it back to back with two.
Yes.
My memory is they shot them both back to back. It's called Gingersnaps Back.
Yes.
And it's basically, you know,
it's like their
technically a prequel or whatever. Yeah. I think it was their attempt to get the two, make a logical reason to have them both back together as sisters. But it's not nearly as fun as these two.
Yeah.
For me, I checked out one of these Vestron releases that I had actually never seen before, but they just put out Parents. From 1989.
Oh, God, I love that movie.
I don't know.
Friday night for the first time.
Oh, my God. I don't know why I You know, because I remember vaguely when that came out and it didn't do well. I think it kind of bombed.
It was a big VHS.
I remember
though.
The VHS.
It was a big VHS. I never watched it because I think I always heard the reputation that, oh, it's not a good movie or whatever. It's not funny or whatever the case is. But I watched this new Blu-ray and I sat up and watched it with Scott Reynolds and his kid, and we were kind of blown away. Like, there is no other film like this. The only thing way I could describe it is it's tonally, it feels like it's like a David Lynch movie meets John Waters. Yeah. Like, it's got that tone where, you know, I mean, the basic premise is you're following the story through the little boy's eyes, and his parents may or may not be cannibals.
Yeah.
But stylistically, the way it's shot and executed, the boy has like these incredible surreal nightmare sequences. Like, there's one where he jumps on the bed in slow motion, and when he hits it, it's like he's hitting a pool, and then the sheet goes in and it's all covered in blood.
Oh.
And you're like, what? Where did that come from? And then I actually posted on my Instagram, I don't know if you saw it, but there's one shot that literally almost made me stand up and cheer. It's basically a character discovering a body, and as soon as they start screaming, it starts at her mouth and pulls all the way back
yes.
through the basement into the upper part of the house, all the way through to the ceiling, out the side of the house, and then you see the parents pulling up. And it's wow. like all this. It's the most elaborate like shot I've ever seen of that sort, and I just was so impressed by it. So firstly, it's a stylistic thing. I didn't find it funny, like laugh out loud funny, but it's definitely got a weird dark tone to it. And ironically enough, the thing that I found interesting was I also watched The Fits on Amazon, which Elric recommended a while ago. And the thing they have in common, I like The Fits. I didn't love The Fits, but I thought it was so interesting. I thought it was one of the most unique movies.
Yeah, that's what
so I thought. Like, yeah. I will definitely watch whatever that filmmaker makes next. But the music, like you said, the score yeah. almost doesn't fit. Parents does something similar where it should be just 50s style, like, you know, music, and it's all just really dreary, dread-inducing music by Angelo Badalamenti.
Yeah. Who does the Lynch
so connection. It's that, and yet then they cut to scenes where Randy Quaid works, which is Toxico. He's devising like a toxic chemical to release, and those scenes have like a quirky like like. So the score like almost doesn't work at all, and yet it works beautifully. I can't explain it. So I've never seen anything quite like it, and I was actually blown away that I'd never seen it.
As a kid, it did nothing for me. I watched it, I saw the cover, and I just went, it's like another comedy.
And that's the thing. Now,
I loved it as a kid.
I think now you'll freaking love it.
Yeah, I want to see it now. Seriously, you sold me on that. Yeah. I mean, I'll watch any of the Vestrons because they look so good.
Yeah. Oh, and it was directed by Bob Balaban, who is an actor.
Oh, yes.
He's a great actor.
Bob is huge.
Bob's hilarious. Yeah, really funny guy.
Super cool movie. I recommend that one.
Man, I'm really bummed. This is like one of those things I almost didn't even want to come on air to talk about, which is a movie I always loved and thought was the coolest thing ever. I watched it, The Nice Beautiful Arrow, and I was just like, it's really boring, and that's Chud.
No!
I am so sorry.
No, you don't mean it. Take it
back. Here's the thing. We watched.
I'm sure it wasn't.
Let me put it this way.
Chud 2 was fun.
I was with another. Here's the worst part. I was with another Chud fan. We were both Chud fans. We got the Arrow. We've been waiting to watch it.
Did you and Dick watch this?
Yeah,
together?
We sat there.
No, Dick, don't do that.
And we looked at each other and go, "Wow, half of this movie is a bunch of bureaucrats in suits in the office talking about what they have to do for the Chud. The Chud scenes." Are fucking still amazing. But in my memory of this movie, the whole movie was Chud scenes. This movie has so many storylines and all of them are pretty dull. And it kills me to say this because I like my memories are so rich of this film. And the memories, you know, you'll still get your great payoffs. But the storyline, when you're seeing these people sitting around talk, you're like, oh, this movie shouldn't be boring. And I wonder if it's something about being so cleaned up for a beautiful Blu-ray release versus seeing something on, you know, pretty bad VHS copy and you see these crazy images and they burn into your mind. I'm not going to put anyone off buying it or watching it. You guys will all still have to make up your Chud for yourself. But for me,
I own Chud too, so I have to buy Chud.
You do have to buy Chud.
I can't have two.
And there will be a lot of great extras on there. I haven't had a chance to like learn those stories. There was a different, it had a totally different, radically different edit for their TV version where the movie ends with John Goodman. He's only in one small cameo. He's at the very last shot of the whole movie. In the other cut, it's in the middle of the movie.
Yep.
And we were watching the two and going, oh, I don't know what, I think the theatrical's still better, but the scene's longer in the other cut. And it's a great scene of Chud's, you know, coming into a diner.
That threw me off too because I had distinct memory of going out with that Diner Massacre and terrifying me as a kid. And then when it happened in the middle, I was like, hold up, what's going on here?
Yeah, it changes kind of the context. But it's still, I mean, look, it's still an awesome movie. It's still fun. But I was surprised. I mean, but that happens. Like, I remember the Street Trash kind of has that. Certain movies have these sequences that are really quite droll, but your memory is going to obviously cling to the fucking crazy shit that happens in the middle. So that was just my two cents. I'm sorry, Aaron from Cavity Colors and everyone. I'm sorry, guys.
So disappointing.
I know.
Okay, well, I caught up with another one that I'll talk about really quick. Did you guys see 2015's Howl?
Yes.
I loved Howl. Okay. Yeah, I think I said the one on the train, right?
Yeah, I don't know how I
talked about
this.
It. I loved it.
Yeah, I caught this last week and I was like, where the fuck did this come from? Like, I for some reason, it just completely was off my radar and I absolutely loved it. So, Rob, you talked about it on the show before.
Yeah, and this is going back maybe a year ago because I had watched Bernard Rose's Frankenstein, which is terrific. And it was a company called Alchemy, which unfortunately no longer exists. But before Frankenstein, there was a trailer for like three other of their releases, and that was one of them. And the Howl trailer is excellent.
Yes.
The movie's pretty good. Obviously, it's not perfect, but it was in the genre of werewolf movies where we don't have a lot and we don't have a lot of good ones. I thought it was exceptionally good.
So did I. It's werewolves on a train. I mean, it's pretty much a group of people get stuck on a train and werewolves start attacking. But it was like a breath of fresh air for me because I haven't seen werewolves in so long, and they were very classic werewolves. The effects were awesome.
Cool. It's gory. Yeah.
And it's a British comedy, so it definitely had this kind of dark satire to it, too. And it was just, I loved it. And for some reason, I never saw it. So.
Paul Hyatt, the director, is a special effects guy.
That makes total sense. Because, man, those transformations.
Attack the Block.
That's right. Yeah, because there was a Descent connection, and that was it. Yeah. No, it's super cool. I like that movie.
Yeah, I highly recommend checking it out, guys. It's on Amazon. I think it was like $3 to rent. Totally worth it.
Right on.
Yeah.
Ryan?
Well, sifting through Amazon Prime, I found a new edition called Offerings. The poster
is
literally just a torso and hands holding a bloody gift box, which reminded me of our poster for The Gift. It's from 89. This guy named Christopher Reynolds wrote and directed it. So, you know, in like horror movies, maybe like The Blob or, you know, The Blob remake or any other kind of horror movie when, you know, the kid is watching a TV, like watching a TV and going, I want to stay and watch a horror movie. And then the director has gone out of his way to do kind of a spoofy horror movie because he can't license an actual horror movie. That's what this movie feels like. Is that movie within the movie.
Nice.
But it's the whole movie. You know, it feels like one of those cheap knockoffs, and it's painful, and it's too silly to be real. But it is the most blatant Halloween ripoff I have ever seen.
Wow. Blatant. Does it have a mask?
Sold.
No mask. But the music is just one chord off, one little note off from John Carpenter's score. Each time they play the thing, it's like, na 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 na, and it's like, what is going on? Weird. But the movie is about this mute kid who falls down a well. Years later, he's, for some strange reason, now he's like super deformed. He breaks out of a hospital and starts going on a killing spree, picking off the kids that kind of like forced him to walk around this well. And he singles out this one girl that he was in love with. And while he's picking off the rest of the teenagers, he takes a body part and then gifts it to this girl. And this girl does nothing in the film but spend the day hanging out, 3 days, hanging out at her house with her girlfriend, like just chilling out. And every once in a while, they'll be like, oh, no, there's like a nose on the cabinet. We need to call the cops. And then they call the cops. And then the cop's like, well, I'm going to bag it. We'll find out if it's a real nose or not. Meanwhile, it's like it looks like a fucking real nose.
Yeah.
They'll come out on the porch and you're like, I found an ear. And then they like the cop comes and he's like, you know, I think you guys are pranking me. She's like, that's an ear. He's like, it could very well be an ear. And he like grabs it with his hand and puts it in a bag and he takes it back to the station. Meanwhile, while this killer is doing all of this stuff, there is a professor who knows about the breakout. And he knows this child, and he knows that he's all grown up, and he's deranged, and he goes after him.
Does he have a trench coat?
No.
I hope he has elbow pads. He has elbow pads.
He's got a pretty sweet sweater.
Okay.
But the funny thing, it dawned on me that it was at once a Halloween ripoff and a ripoff of Rob Zombie's Halloween.
How funny.
Because it goes into the backstory of explaining why this kid's all fucked up.
So it's before Halloween, Rob Zombie's Halloween, but still ripped it off.
Yes. It was good. Yes. You know, it feels like You know, he goes into the backstory. You know, at the beginning, we meet the new kid, and he's got like this white trash mom who treats him like shit. And she's like, "I saw what you did to those turtles. I know that you act like all mutant shit, but you killed those turtles and you killed those pets."
She's on a white horse.
Oh,
so
yes,
maybe Rob Zombie saw Offerings and was like, "This is the most brilliant movie ever."
I want a blend of
Rob
two
Zombie
things.
Couldn't afford the rights to that.
It's funny. There's some almost comical kill scenes that are pretty funny. The guy gets this kid on a workbench, and he puts his head in a vise, and then he's like firing up the chainsaw, but the chainsaw doesn't work, and he's like, ugh. And he grabs the drill and he starts to drill the guy's head, and he's like, the drill goes out, and he's like, god damn it. So then he tries to figure out one more way to kill this guy in the vise. But anyways, it's a real piece of shit, but
I glowingly endorse it.
But if you need no, but I still saw it because it was. I realized it was kind of like a slasher movie that I had never seen.
So this
gets
the Microwave Massacre Award.
Oh, very much. But I mean, like, but I could get through Offerings.
Yeah. You
know? I can get through Offerings. There's
what
some
a
great
endorsement.
There's some really great one-liners. I wrote them down. There's one where this girl pulls up to this kid who's like going home. She's like, I really need your notes for history, and he's like, okay. And she's like, bye. And she races off, and he goes, all these chicks want me is for my notes. And then that's it, you know. And then the cop actually goes, he walks into the house and grabs the nose, and he's like, got any more body parts around here? It's like, oh my god, this movie. Anyways, it's on Amazon Prime. I think it just hit because it popped up in my queue right
now. It's been in my wish list for a couple weeks because I think someone in our group posted about it, because I've been tracking all these slashers I haven't seen, and that's one that I, for some reason, I thought it was a Christmas movie because of the title.
Oh, right.
So I kind of got excited there.
Wow. I saw Wild Beast, which was the Severin title that we promoted last
week.
Which is
nutty.
It's pretty nutty. Ryan started watching. You didn't finish it yet, though, right?
Yeah,
I
took NyQuil beforehand, and I realized that a combination of NyQuil and Wild Beast might have been the best combo. I had very vivid dreams after that, but also I woke up during a very pivotal moment where I told Rob, and I was like, dude, did I see a cheetah chase a car?
Right before we started, he's like, I left it off when there was like a cheetah chasing a girl in a car, and I'm like, yep. And I was like, did you get to the elephants on the runway? And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, there's a bunch of elephants that cause a plane crash because they're on the runway.
Seeing eye dogs and rats.
And so, yes. So listen, if those things sell you that, then you have to check it out. I liked it. I didn't love it, but then again, these kind of animal movies are not my favorite types of horror movies. And the only thing that bothered me, and again, it's pretty brief, but very early in the opening, there is I love the title card because it like focuses on like, I think, a tiger, and then the wild beast with zinger.
Five minutes,
and it comes out, and you're like, what is this?
But then the next title card that comes up over like a very nondescript city, it says, a Northern European city. And it goes, oh, okay.
That's the next title card. But then there's a horse head. It kind of caught me off guard. It's not like Cannibal Holocaust style, but it does cut right to a shot of a horse head. And then when it pulls back, you realize that the head is not actually attached to a horse, but it's a real horse head. Aww. And they're kind of chopping it up.
They're chopping it up to feed to the zoo animals.
To the lions and stuff like that. So I was like, oh no, I hope this isn't going to be one of those like animal violence sort of deals. Yeah. But it's not. I mean, there's just so much. You know, the animals are drinking PCP. There's PCP that leaked into the water, and they're all drinking it. So then an alarm, like something with the fences goes wrong, so they all open.
Yep.
So now every animal is on PCP and running through the city.
And the elephants fucking burst through a goddamn brick wall, guys. Yeah.
How do they make
the elephants?
How do you make a low-budget, like, zoo break?
And especially at this era where it's like, well, those are real animals.
What's so great, too, is that the PCP getting into the water / PCP being drunk by animals has its own theme music. It is so good because they show like the seeing eye dog go and start drinking the water, and it's like, he's drinking the PCP.
So yeah, it's a lot of fun. I would love to hear. I know a lot of people picked it up since last episode, so I'd love to hear from you guys.
You know what I picked up as well? I picked up The Survivor.
Ooh,
sight unseen.
I just got it. I'm going to check it out.
I'm pretty psyched. I just got Deadly, what is it? Now I can't even remember. The new Scream Factory one, Deadly Tales?
Dead Time Stories.
Yeah, it's
just
pretty cool.
Came today.
Anthology and I.
Save the anthology talk, boys.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, we're going to save it. I worked on all the special features for that.
Oh, brilliant. So, yeah. I can't wait to check that one out.
Anything else?
Yeah, I got a couple of quick ones.
I saw
three short films, and this is a pretty cool thing that they're doing on Shudder.
On Shudder, yeah.
And I think it's really cool. So I watched all three, about a week ago, I saw The Stylist by, I'm going to totally butcher your last name, Jill Gavizigian?
I had to say this at Etheria when I announced her. Gavizigarian?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was close with that one.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the tone of this one. It was a lot of fun. I thought the performance was really good by the lead. It's a very simple film, but it was elegant and shot well, and I think it deserved the kudos it's been getting. El Gustavo Cooper's The Home, which I watched last night, and I love the scale of that one. Like, he made a film that feels a lot bigger than it is. Again, it reminded me, what I say straight after, I think it was like, it's Lights Out Monster doing Inside. He's coming to get the babies from everyone. Yeah. But I liked the way it looked, and it felt like a short portion of a feature of something that could really...
I've seen that one. That's a really good one.
Yeah, it's a fun film. And then I saw Brioni Kidd, who runs the Stranger With My Face Film Festival in Tasmania, and she's in our Facebook group, The Room at the Top of the Stairs, which is a few years older. But of the three films, that's one probably like that plays to my interest in style of filmmaking a little more, even though it's very strained and kind of a little more open-ended in its style. But I could recognize the flatting kind of drama for having lived in flats like that. And I liked it. But I liked all three. But what I really liked about it was this idea of a curatorial short film, because there's too many shorts online for us to possibly ever go, I'm just going to browse through thousands of short films to decide what to watch. But if you trust Shudder and then they start posting these and don't overdo it, I think it's a really nice way to market these films.
Yeah, and my recommendation also, because I get Shudder through Amazon, and it's very hard. I had all these shorts that you mentioned, I had to look up on Amazon. So what I recommend doing is if you do get it through Amazon, have your Amazon open, go to Shudder.com. Because on their main page, it says, you know, all the curated stuff, the new shorts, everything. And then all you have to do is search the title once you see it on there. And on Amazon, it'll say available with your Shudder subscription. Okay. And you could add it. Because the Amazon Shudder page is not 100% there yet.
Yeah, it only shows you so much. I go to recently added usually when I'm on that.
Yeah, but the shorts, I don't know if they've been showing up on Amazon. So that's my recommendation is have Shudder's webpage up. So you can just search them by name. Yeah. But yeah.
And,
I was going to say, while you guys are on Shudder, I still recommend checking out Behind the Wall. It's the one
series.
Have you seen it yet?
Yeah, I started a while ago. They also added a Japanese series, but I haven't watched that. And just really quickly, I wanted, because we talked about it briefly last, the Clinical movie, which is a Netflix original. I wanted to watch it as well, just because then we could see if we were balanced on Alistair Legrand movie. A couple cool things about it. Vanessa Shaw, the actress, who I've had a crush on since Eyes Wide Shut, and Aaron Stafford are both in it, and they're both the stars, two leads of The Hills Have Eyes remake. The main guy and the girl. Yep. So they're on screen together, which was a little bit of fun. But there's a guy in it called Kevin Ram, who was one of the main guys in Mad Men. He gives a really great horror performance in this movie. Like, it's the highlight of the film for me. Is like watching, it's a man without a face, Mel Gibson type performance. But I didn't know who it was until the flashbacks happened. And then I was like, holy shit, it's the guy from Mad Men. I really enjoyed the performance. I thought it was a really well made movie on a directing and shooting level. But my problem is like psychiatry as a subject. It's kind of got the same problem that the patients of psychiatry does, which is they talk too much.
Yeah, you know? It was a very talky film.
I'm just not – it's not from that kind of movie. And in general, I've seen other films about psychiatrists or that kind of setup. And for whatever reason, I'm always a little disengaged because I'm listening to people talk about their problems for too much of the setup. There's a certain point where the storyline – becomes clear, like where you see, oh, I see where this is going to head in the next 40 minutes. And I think that was interesting, but it happened quite late in the film for me. So I was like already kind of out of it. But I think there's some good stuff in there. I think the ending, towards the end, I think there's a pretty awesome horror moment right for the end where I was like, oh, that's really cool. But I thought, it's hard. There's some topics that I don't think translate as well to films. Yeah. And I think talking is a big, unless you're Woody Allen. When it comes to horror, I think that's a big one for me personally.
Right.
But it's on Netflix free, and it's definitely more of a thriller. It definitely has a lot more, like, to me, 90s thriller tropes than it does necessarily horror. So I think if you're a thriller fan, that might be more your bag.
Right on. And anything else, Becca?
No.
Ryan?
No.
You had one more.
I had one more, and I want to apologize.
Here comes Elric.
Oh, you
better listen to this.
Oh,
so,
no.
You ready?
I bought my international Blu-ray of Friday Night Part 2. And I watched it over the weekend.
Can I come and hug you?
And I have been unfair. I have been very unfair to this sequel.
He's a rat. Elric took off the headphones. He's going to hug Ryan.
Just bring it in.
There you go,
Tommy Lee.
There you go. There you go. I kind of watched it with clear eyes, and it's a fun movie. I still have two massive problems with it.
The opening? But
No, not the opening. I love the opening. I love Charlie going through therapy and explaining the first movie. I still feel like the hey, we're all going bowling gig. It's not fun.
You didn't like
fun.
The scene where they bowl?
No, I hate the scene when they bowl. I hate the scene when they bowl, and I hate when Regine does her Fright Night bit. I thought that the Regine taking over Fright Night as a show just was an unnecessary kind of
thing. I agree
thing.
With that. Yeah.
But they needed something personal to attack Peter Vincent with.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, overall, I mean, like, as a movie, you still wonder why it exists. You're like, why am I watching this story? Why am I watching Charlie and Peter go through this again?
Yeah.
And at the end, Charlie's still Charlie, you know? Now he's talking about getting married and having babies. But Charlie is always going to be Charlie. And Peter is always going to be Peter. So I wonder, like, why does it exist? But
turn off your
ride
brain.
The ride is just fun.
There's some gags in there that are pretty great.
Yeah.
There's some good stuff.
Especially the guy from Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, yeah, John Green.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Him trying to seduce her on dates is just great.
Like, yeah.
And then looking back at the dog. And
you know. I mean, two words, Julie Carmen.
Yes.
I mean, you know.
Julie Carmen, yes.
She walked into me in the bathroom once. Did so I tell cute. You guys that story?
What?
Here?
No. Oh. It was actually Tom Holland was having like a little like Fright Night reunion get together, and I was there, and he doesn't have a lock on his door. Thankfully, I was all done, so it wasn't too awkward. It was just like, oh, I'm just washing my hands. And I'm like, and you're beautiful. You can use the bathroom now. So anyway, there's my little personal story for you.
Nice. Charming.
But but I got to say, that Blu-ray is beautiful.
It's great.
It was great to see a widescreen.
Who put that one out?
It was on we bought it from Diabolik DVD. Rob put out a call on Facebook. It was like, Fright Night 2 is out there. We all like
it's an
all swarmed
region,
onto Diabolik
DVD.
Sold
out that day.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I just wrote down to get it, and now I will
have it. You need
it. Well, no, just check.
Free.
They might have a restock.
I think I don't think they're restocking it because although it's listed as region free and that you had no problems,
right.
Some people, including myself who bought it, can't play it on my particular player. So apparently, I have a Sony and Sony tends to be very fickle unless it's a PlayStation and I don't have a PlayStation. So I think a few people had issues with it. So Diabolik was like, I don't know if we'll restock it because of that.
Yeah.
Because they can't guarantee it. You know?
Oh, that's painful.
But I do have it and I'm holding on to it because I will invest in an all region player soon anyway. And I'm sure it'll play on that. So.
And that brings us to one of our other dream guests I would love is Tommy Lee Wallace. Because I think
he's
one of the most
in town, that'd be amazing.
Fun filmmakers.
Yeah. And I don't know, before we wrap up and bring our guests
we got tons of guests coming in any minute now.
Well, we've all seen XX now, and I'm sure we'll discuss it with them. But I mean, we all had fun watching it. It's a fun anthology.
Yeah. Very fun.
There is not a bad – it's rare to not have one – and this is so we're not kissing their ass when they're here, but there's not a bad short in this four short films, and there's a wraparound. So, I mean, that already says quite a lot for an anthology. I think it's hard to do nowadays.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's bring them up. Hey, Becca, I need something real cool to wear this weekend. What can I wear?
Have you tried Fright Rags horror t-shirts?
Why, yes, I have.
Since 2003, they've been bringing horror fans from around the world the best in horror t-shirts and apparel. They are focused on creating original artwork commissioned by only the top artists and print on super soft ring-spun cotton shirts.
I do love me some soft shirts.
Hell yeah, you do. They have always got amazingly licensed properties, and their product line covers far more than just shirts, including socks that Ryan's wearing right now.
That's right.
Got your feet all wrapped in some Fright Rags. Lounge pants and even horror masks, and they are currently launching a new line of Wax Packs trading cards, starting with the Reanimator.
Mm.
And they are offering a discount for Shockwaves listeners, so head to www.fright-rags.com. Did I get the website right this
you
time,
got it.
Guys? Excellent. Yeah. Enter the code SHOCKWAVES10 at checkout and you will get 10% off your order. The code is good till March 31st, so go get some Fright Rag swag right now.
I'm using it right away.
Heck yeah, you can also check them out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Damn Skippy. And when you go, tell them Shockwave sent you.
Shockwave sent you guys. Say hi to Ben for us. We love him.
Ryan, why do you have this smooth radio voice all of a sudden? Is it because all our guests are ladies tonight? Is that what it
all.
Is?
No,
all
right. This is my usual podcast voice.
All right.
I would that for a free t-shirt.
I want the lounge pants.
Hey, Fright Rags, send us a gift box for the XX team because that's who we have in the house tonight.
Right?
Please, not size fat bastard. You know, maybe women's sizes.
You guys get that too. Like every single time I get a promo shirt, it's an extra large.
It's
and
then
I'm
bastard.
Like, I got another nightshirt, guys.
So here's who you're hearing tonight. You have Jovanka Vukovic. Jovanka, say hi.
Hi.
Roxanne Benjamin.
Hello.
And Sofia, the quiet Carrillo.
Hola, ¿cómo están?
How are you?
Hola.
This is...
She quietly just cursed you.
Did she really? Shit.
That happens a lot in this conference room, I think. A lot of curses and hexes.
We have 3 out of the 5 who make up the directorial team behind XX. Who we're missing tonight is Karin Kusama and St. Vincent, a.k.a. Annie Clark. And they were all... at CineFamily last night for a special Los Angeles screening that I heard went like gangbusters.
A lot of fun, man.
Shockwaves really was in the house.
Like, everybody was there. It was like we couldn't leave because we kept running into people we knew. It was awesome.
Well, Elric also likes to talk to everybody.
Yeah, but Elric drinks a lot.
It was a fun audience to watch it with.
I'm just a silent member. Well, no, and the most glowing praise I can ever give an anthology, because we were talking about anthologies before, is there's not a weak film, and that's so rare to see, especially if you have, I mean, I think one of the smart things is limiting it to 4 mm-hmm. and a wraparound is really smart, because usually they go 7 and 2 of them are just unwatchable at a certain level. So to me, the fact that all 4 films are strong on their own and stand up as films was really rewarding.
And a wraparound.
We were talking about, we'll get into that a bit more because I want to watch that again.
Yes.
Because that had layers.
Yeah. It confounded me. I must see more.
Yeah.
I had no idea what was going on, but I was mesmerized.
For our listeners out there, the wraparound is an animated kind of segment that stretches you from tail to tail, and it's really unnerving and weird and creepy and really well done.
So, we mentioned Jodorowsky before the show,
yeah.
Right?
It's totally Jodorowsky. We saw it.
Some holy mountain love.
Yeah.
Sophia managed in like 90 seconds to encapsulate what my entire like 12 and a half minute thing was.
Nice.
That's pretty cool.
Nice.
Because I mean, that's all she was given really was a log line. So the only person that knew what we were all doing was Sophia and, of course, Todd Brown, the producer. But she was basically given just a one sentence about, you know, Jovanka's segment is about a kid who stops eating and Roxanne's is about, well, what is yours about? Tell them.
Death.
She's the puppet.
And so she actually spent like 2 months working on her segment, her wraparound segment.
So you had the most time out of all of them.
Yes, maybe it's not best to have a lot of time because you just go back to the first idea and say, oh, maybe it's not that good. So
you
maybe
start
I should work.
It.
Yes, that's not the best idea to have more time. But I had a lot of time since I was invited, and then I said no, and then I said yes, like I told you. So this has been an adventure. Yes.
Yeah, it's been 4 years.
Yes.
4 years.
Yeah.
Since me and Todd had that initial conversation. And my segment has been finished for more than 2 years. Karin's been finished for over a year. Mm. And then the rest of it came together super fast. Last year...
Annie and I finished ours like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, practically. Wow. Like pretty much. I mean, they came in like so quickly. And, you know, Roxanne helped Annie write her segment. And I can't believe you guys shot yours in 3 fucking days.
Yeah, we had 3 days for each one of those.
I had 5 days and 1 week of prep, and so did Karin. She had 5 days because, like, we wanted to do a civilized shoot, right? And so these maniacs did theirs in, like, turned it over in record time, really, because she's, like, one of the heroes. We would have missed our Sundance deadline again had Roxanne not said... because we lost a director, and she said, well, I can do one, and I can write one, and I can turn it around and, like, very quickly, and she did.
Nice.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Well, who I mean, you talked...
And she, like, threw a guy through a window twice.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, threw a windshield twice, you know.
Well done.
For the task.
I think she did it for the short, too.
Right, yeah.
That's what I call a Friday.
Well, you talk about this fateful Todd Jovanka meeting. Who called it? Was it Todd, you?
Well, we both had the same idea at the exact same time. So I was wanting to do an all-women's anthology, and I was going to crowdfund it, and I was going to reach out to all the women directors that I knew and, you know, try to do it that way. And then, fortuitously, I got a phone call from Todd, and he said... what do you think about doing an all-women's horror anthology? And so, like, well, as a matter of fact, I would like to do that. And he was able to bring financing because of his relationships, you know, as a producer. And his title was better than mine. And I quickly abandoned my concept, which was going to take a lot more time and effort. and joined forces with him on his idea. Mm. So XX was really Todd's idea. So he's the great white male feminist behind XX. He's the guy who never gave up on it. And when we could have easily just said, fuck it, let's just hire a couple of dudes and finish this thing because it's taking forever and Magnolia would really like the movie to come out. But he remained committed to it being women directors. And, you know, here we are, finally, four years later. Oh, so, yeah, lots of challenges, obviously, over like three different, making a movie over three countries and multiple unions. So all kinds of obstacles presented themselves that we could not have expected, right?
Right. Well, I was going to say during the last 4 years, we've seen, you know, a rise of anthologies. And Roxanne, you know, you're behind VHS and you've had a little bit of, you've had kind of the experience. So did you guys reach out to anybody, you know, just for the, look, we're putting together an anthology. What's the best process? Not the creative process, but technically speaking, you know? No.
Todd was just like, we made a list and we just started reaching out to people and seeing who we could attach to it. And it actually was, you know, remarkably difficult to find a group of women who were available and able to do it on the budget and on the timeline that we needed. And
that's so, actually what we ran into with VHS too, because we looked for female directors.
You said it was so hard.
Right? And it just always ends up being like all of us who are either sitting in Simon or Evan's living room who are like, well, I guess it's just us again. You know, most people don't want to make things at that budget level that are non-union, that are available in that time period, that don't have other stuff going on. So it's like, if you take a small pool and then make it smaller and smaller and smaller, like, we're just running out of...
It was hard. It was hard.
But it took you 4 years?
And we lost, and we lost some directors. We had all these lineup changes. We lost some when we went union because the project went DGA. And then we lost some directors for good reasons, right? You know, because they got busy directing. Mm-hmm. And then in some cases for very tragic reasons, like we lost Antonia Bird to cancer.
Oh, yeah.
During the production of this.
And the movie's dedicated to her, right?
Yes, it is because we...
Wow, you know, that was that soon?
Yeah, so she...
Holy cow, time flies.
Yeah, I know. And she's been gone now for more than 2 years. Yeah. So she was like, I love it. I want to do it. I just have some stuff I need to take care of. And she wasn't feeling great. And she took some time off work. And then she didn't even tell us that she was battling cancer.
Right.
And then we just received word that she had lost her battle to cancer. So we were holding a place for her. And, Antonia Bird is one of the few women that, when I was, you know, growing up and watching movies, and I saw a woman's name at the end of the credits and went, fuck, if she could do it, maybe so can I. Mm-hmm. So she's a bit of a hero to me, a personal hero. So the movie's dedicated to her memory, and because we must remember on whose shoulders we stand, you know, she blazed a trail for us. If it wasn't for people like Antonia Bird, we wouldn't be here.
And just for those people out there that are listening, she directed Ravenous, which is
Priest.
And Priest.
And yesterday we were just, I told you yesterday that I was very surprised on the idea of the heart of the little girl, of my grab round. Mm-hmm. it is a bird.
Yeah.
So we were just very happy with this.
The thing that gives life to the human character at the end is a bird.
Yes.
So we thought that was incredibly poetic.
Sophia
pointed that out.
We just realized that when we were at the cine family. Like, oh my God, this is very nice.
It was so beautiful. Like I was fighting back tears last night when you pointed that out to me.
You know, there was several names attached to this film at different times, and obviously the challenge is timing, basically, is why some people might not have been able to do it. I'm curious how you landed on Annie Clark, St. Vincent, because I'm a huge fan of hers as a musician, and I think she's an artist in every sense of the word with her music videos and stuff, but not somebody I would think of as a director for a horror anthology. Once her name kind of got thrown in the ring, I was like, oh, that's interesting. So how did that happen for you guys, landing on her as the fourth the fourth of five directors.
Mary Harron got The Handmaid's Tale greenlit up in Canada, and we were very happy for her, but that means we lost her as a director, and so we were back to the drawing board trying to replace her with someone, and it was actually John Van Thaden at Magnolia who suggested Annie, and Todd emailed me and said, what do you think? And I was like, I love it, because she's a complete wild card. We have no idea what she's going to make. So I loved it, and I guess Todd had a connection to her through another musician, right?
Sufjan Stevens.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
So the rest is, you can tell the rest.
Yeah, because Roxanne, you co-wrote this thing with her.
Yeah.
I thought the funniest thing at the Q&A last night was that, because it's obvious, hers is definitely more of a comedy, a black comedy, although she said she was trying to make a Michael Haneke film.
Yeah, that was the whole came from this, she has this this art book called Toilet Paper, and there's this very austere image of this amazing, you know, completely clean lines, living room that just has this rug in the middle of it with just feet sticking out. And that was kind of what we kept calling the Magna Carta shot. We kind of built around that image and a true story of a friend of hers who had had a death occur in a house where she had to protect children from that knowledge for just a few moments more so that, you know, after they find this out, it changes everything. It destroys your innocence. They'll never have this person in their life again. So we were, you know, we were just sitting in her place for like about a month developing this story, and we were just, everything was very serious and, you know, very dark. And then about halfway through, we just kind of realized like, oh shit, we're making a black comedy. Like, now we describe it as A Weekend at Bernie's meets Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. You know, it's just kind of this suburban housewife horror story of like trying to fit in a glass house, literally. And yeah, once we figured out that it was a comedy, like everything just kind of fell into place. All the obstacles fell into place. And we put the ticking clock to it, which was like my favorite part.
Yeah, the great thing is that we reached out and she said yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, she could have easily said no, I'm too busy, or why would I want to do that?
Mm-hmm. She always
she's like, yeah, I'd like to direct a horror movie. I had to do my Annie. I'd like to direct a horror movie. Yes, I'd like to do that. I could just see her saying that.
Yeah, and she always says, you know, like in music, they don't just hand you a bunch of money and say, here, go make something creative, and then not expect you to pay it back. So she was like, somebody's going to give me this chunk of money to go do something artistic, like, of course, I'm on board. Yeah. And she's not a horror movie fan per se. She's not that she dislikes them. She's just terrified.
Yeah, they scare her. And yeah. She covers her eyes.
She's,
you know,
not seen
the
whole movie, I think, once.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Sophia's not really, you know, not like a huge horror person?
No, because I'm also get scared, and I just can't sleep for weeks sometimes. So usually it's not my.
Now, does this date back to childhood? Because we always talk to everybody that comes on the show about their earliest horror recollections, and I definitely want to hear about it from Ivanka because I've known you for years and I don't know this. But I mean, was there a movie you saw when you were a little kid that was too much, and you're like, all right, I'm not a horror fan, can't do it?
A lot of them. Let's say Chucky, for example. I know.
Makes perfect sense.
It's a sweet holiday.
I'm so sorry, but Chucky really. And also Eat.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
It.
The clown?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that was not. No. And I don't know why, but in Mexico, you could see The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, it was available to see it, so. Who does that? Come on. So,
who makes The Exorcist readily available?
Come on. So I saw this little... I had the chance to see this movie also. And I think that I have some, let's say, I just kind of forgot some of the scenes. But I have this sensation,
the feeling
of the movie. Yeah. So at one point, somebody told me, a teacher told me, please don't do that anymore. Just don't see
the horror
movies because you won't sleep. So I thought, that's a very good idea. I shouldn't just... And then I just stopped.
But she doesn't consider her stuff to be horror.
No, I know.
I know.
I'd love to ask her that, because she was one of the first people that you had in mind for this anthology, right? How did you discover her work?
Well, I saw one of her films at Fantasia one year, and I think one of her other films, your movie, was at Sundance as well.
Yes.
And, I became a big fan because it was like... I mean, I hate to use the comparisons, you know, because Jan Svankmajer and Brothers Quay, but it was like this Mexican version of them, but with a woman's sensibility, because she has this obsession with dolls, and that's that Julio, that Cortázar story, you know, the story. Yeah, and I was like, I know what this woman is thinking. And and then when I met her, she told me, I'm very much influenced by that Cortázar story where the guy is putting, he's like a doll maker and he's putting things inside the doll, like perversions. And, you know, and the kids would buy the dolls and bring them home and open them and find these weird things inside the dolls. And Sophia, without giving away a lot of her secrets, she puts these like kind of personal talismans inside every doll that she makes. And so it's very important, the heart. Like these creatures being animated and having a heart is really important to her.
Yes, for me, it's something that you might not see, but maybe you are going to feel it. There's something strange in the dolls. And it's also a game for me. I really get... it is very funny to have them with a heart inside. Sometimes it's a flower, sometimes it's a mole.
Yeah, she puts her feet. Like teeth, like her own teeth from her skull.
And
she wonders why we don't think it's scary.
I'm sorry.
So
they mentioned that at the screening. So seriously, like your own teeth are the ones that we see in the movie.
Yes.
So clearly horror has had some sort of everlasting effect.
But she's only discovering it now, and this is what I love. I love being part of this part in her life where she's accepting that her stuff is dark and maybe, you know, horror is a home for her. And
embracing.
It's just emerging, like literally right now. So it feels really good.
You're obsessed with dolls, and it started with Chucky. So I think we found the connection.
Yes, of course, of course.
Stop motion Chucky film. That would be cool.
Well, I was going to say, now that you're kind of embracing it, have you revisited old fears, old films that have scared you?
Yes, I should just go there again.
Just do it.
With my new, you know.
We will all help you. It's
I'm
okay.
all there all now, so I'm hoping.
I mean, she shot her segment in a haunted house that was built in like 1900.
Yes.
Tell them that story.
Okay, I'm going to try.
Because I didn't shoot in a haunted house, so mine's not that interesting.
Yeah, it was on like a horse ranch.
No, it is an old house in the center of Guadalajara, downtown, let's say. And it is an old house. We're just trying to find this old house. And then suddenly this house was available to work in. And so I had this kind of, let's say, I tried to be very educated with the places and with things and try to ask for permission. And this is a very old house, and we were just like feeling like, you know, cold and the cuckoos. I don't know how to say it.
Goosebumps?
Yes, that. So every day I was just kind of asking for permission. I didn't want to just... go there and try to work there like, I'm going to do this. And No. I was really trying to be very to have a lot of respect for the house and for the energies there, because there was these kind of shadows and you just could kind of feel or see, but it was like, we're just working, we are going to make a very nice movie, so let's do this together. And I didn't want to have any ghost from that house in my studio, so I was trying to really be very educated and ask for permission to work there. And that's for me only, I know. That's for me.
Sure.
Let's say that's not very... It's probably not true for everybody, but for me it's very important to be like, Okay, we are going to do the XX round segment here. So, hey, sign the release, please. okay. Something so, like that.
Well, I was going to say, going back, Roxanne, I've known you for I don't know how long, but I don't know your roots, your horror roots. Going back to Rob's original question, you know, what was the kind of first horror film that got you solidified in the genre? And
it wasn't film.
It wasn't film.
No, it was Stephen Gammell.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the woods, like literally like an animal. Rural Pennsylvania, we didn't have a lot of...
Rural Virginia.
Yeah, we didn't have movie theaters or, you know, any movie theater that was within like an hour's distance was just showing whatever blockbuster because there'd be like it's a two screen theater, yeah. You know, and in the winter you're just kind of cabin fevered.
Jack Torrance and The Shining.
Yeah, completely, 100%. So it was books and my mom and my aunts were big horror fans and it was also It, but it was the book and Pet Sematary and yeah. Carrie. And stuff like that that I was reading when I was like six, yeah. That was just a terrible idea to give your 6 year old. But it was just what was around the house, that and like old Dean Koontz novels, yeah. Honestly. And then,
which in and of themselves, they all had really striking covers as
yeah,
well.
Like yeah, all the covers
just like a green
were like
claw coming out of a sewer.
Oh,
you know?
God, yeah, they were the worst.
Pet Cemetery was just yep. A screaming cat.
Yeah, the Dean Koontz ones. Like I remember The Bad Place. It was just a hotel, yeah. But it was like the scariest thing you could possibly imagine.
Or there'd
imagine.
Be like a watchtower yeah. In the dark, and like you know just. Your imagination would kind of run yeah. Wild with that. That and, yeah, the Stephen Gammell artwork in Scary Stories.
Yeah.
That, like, just completely destroyed me. Even I remember those from, like, before I can read, like, looking at those images. Wow. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Did you go see them at the Del Toro exhibit?
No.
He had a bunch of those, like, the originals up there.
Wow. They're even gooier in person.
Ooh, it was gooier.
Yeah. Yeah. And I loved that artwork because even the stories in the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, even the ones that Alvin Schwartz that put in that weren't scary, there was What About Playing Baseball in Heaven? It still had these like absolutely horrific pictures
terrifying.
Along with it.
Like I feel like there's a whole generation of us that are just like fucked from those. Mm-hmm. You know?
What age were you when you finally did see kind of the cinematic adaptations of that? Because I always think about Romero and Craven as being two directors who didn't see a lot of any horror. Mm-hmm. I mean, Craven used to say at least he didn't really see horror
until his 30s or
yeah,
something,
yeah,
right?
Until quite late. Like and Romero was something similar
because yeah.
Their religious backgrounds. But
well, it was probably like Gilbert Gottfried and the USA Up All Night, honestly, because we didn't yeah. Have anything. Yeah. Else, so it was seeing like old B movies on there. Mm-hmm. Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, I remember being like a small child.
And Bug.
Again, it's like my parents' fault, them rolling tomatoes into the living room while my brother and I were watching it. And like neither of us could eat tomatoes until we were like 20.
I remember like when Jaws came out, everybody was afraid to go swimming. I was afraid to turn on the fucking tap.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
We had a swimming pool in our backyard, yeah. A whole 4-foot swimming pool. But I always swore that the outline of the maple tree was like morphing into a shark every single time I went swimming.
Or because of it, too. Yeah, I was terrified of drains.
Yeah.
Any sort of drain.
Yeah.
What about you?
I guess for me, it was a little different. I grew up, I was born and raised in Toronto, Canada. And we had a very sort of relaxed attitude in Canada. So they would start playing horror movies on city TV at like 9 p.m. And by 11, it would be blue movies. So like Shannon Tweed and like Tinto Brass, full-on softcore porn. And so I had childhood insomnia, which was not improved by my watching of horror films. And so I would just stay up all night and watch these movies. And some of my earliest memories were like the Poe cycle of Corman films, like The Mask of the Red Death. And those were on because, you know, City TV had bought the whole library. We also didn't have a tradition of horror hosts, so we just had this one show called The Hilarious House of Frightenstein, and it was hosted by Vincent Price, and it was like a children's variety show, and this one guy, Billy Van, played almost all of the characters. So like a Wolfman character, like a Wolfman Jack character, and Dracula, and Igor, and so on, and... So, you know, I and my mom, when it was my turn at movie night, I would always run straight to the horror section and pick something, anything with a red dot on it.
Oh, the red dot. The red dot.
Anything with a red dot. And so, you know, I mean, I saw stuff I shouldn't have seen. And I don't think it's a good idea to show kids, you know, stuff that's not age appropriate. Because I remember seeing, like, Fulci's zombie and Olga Carlatos getting that 12-inch spike in her eye and breaking off. And I didn't sleep for a long time. And I saw The Exorcist when I was really young, probably, like, 7 or 8 years old. And, you know, that movie put a permanent wrinkle in my psyche. Like, I thought I was watching a documentary. Because, you know, when you're a kid, your magical thinking is still very active. And I thought what I was watching was real. But it's like, you know, it's that, yeah, it's like a junkie, you know, like it became like a junkie. And I kept watching horror movies because I wanted to feel the same kind of fucking terror that, you know, as I did when I was a kid. And also, I was very lonely as a kid, my parents didn't celebrate Christmas, and so I basically, horror movies were like my best friends during my loneliest times growing up. So I feel like, you know, very loyal to horror films. Yeah.
Now, is genre for all three of you, is genre something you want to maintain and stay in? You know, I know some filmmakers who have come up and they're genre lovers, but they want to go all over the place. Me, I just want to stay in this, you know, but I know a lot of people want to kind of branch out, do a romantic comedy. Do you have romantic comedies in you? Do you have straight dramas, or is it always going to be a little
rom-com skewed? Rom-com is like the ultimate horror to me.
Excellent.
No, thanks.
Well, if I could make comedies, but I can't. I would love to, but I just can't. It's not in my blood, so.
I don't know how, because I think that it's way harder to make someone laugh than it is to scare them, right? Because it's very easy to just go like, boo, right? Yeah. But making someone laugh is so subjective, right? Yeah, like, what's funny? And we're talking about how, you know, a lot of horror is also timing, just like comedy.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like comedy and horror are very linked in that.
But I can't make people laugh. I don't know how. I really don't. Yeah, I mean, you seem release. To have a natural gift for it.
It's funny. It's most of the writing I do is with comedy-oriented people. I write with Susan Burke a lot, She wrote Smashed, which is very much not a comedy, but it's very dark. And a lot of the people that I work with, like Dana Gould, was in Southbound.
I love Dana.
Yeah, and he's a comedian. So I like working with comedians, not only because they're good with improv, but I feel like they're also very dark, just naturally.
The best Vincent Price impression.
Yeah,
have you heard him do his Vincent Price impression?
No, I've heard him do a lot of different Planet of the Apes
impressions. We should call him now and ask him.
We've got Vincent Price on the show.
That'd be amazing.
He's
so good. Yeah. It's funny. Patton Oswalt I saw out and about at Sunday. You know, but he was at every horror screening that I saw. Yeah. And I was like,
I always see him at Secret Headquarters too.
Yeah,
just like randomly.
Yeah, he's just a genre fan, you know. And they got that weird darkness to him, and I bet he's got something in him. I bet he could do.
I want
to do a big space movie, big space action movie.
Nice,
that'd be
like
cool.
A women's prison space.
Oh, it's a women's prison movie in space.
I would love to do Bitch Planet. That would be amazing.
I haven't read Bitch Planet yet. I have the first trade, but I haven't had a chance to check it out yet.
Wait, what's Bitch Planet?
Bitch Planet is a comic. Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Yes. It's about a world where all the non-conformist women go to a fucking prison planet.
Uh-huh.
Because they refuse to conform. Yeah.
But also the author has this great listserv where you get a text from her just randomly every once in a while that says bitches get shit done. And it's always like some like really profound thing.
On a t-shirt, actually.
It's great because it'll just be like, you'll be stuck in traffic and doing some, like having the worst day, and it'll just be like, you can get through this. And you're like, you're right, phone. I can't.
Right, Kelly Sue.
Yeah. There's always something I'm going to drop John Carpenter's Ghosts of Mars on the table for a second, just for a brief second. But I always thought it was like completely, because the movie is set in a world, it's a matriarchy. That's the setup. And I always felt like that was completely it was set up and then it just kind of disappeared for a little bit. And then it circled back around when you landed back on Earth. But I always thought that would have been like a cool spinoff. Like, take us back to the planet. Yeah. Take us back to Earth and explore that world, you know?
My other love outside of like genre is astronomy and physics. So I really want to tie those two worlds together in some way.
I know this is going to come off as kind of a broad question, but I was curious about the origins of your filmmaking. And what I mean by that is, you know, obviously I know Jovanka as a very strong writer for Remorgue. And, you know, I'm just curious if there was a point where you knew as a writer you wanted to be a filmmaker. And the same thing with Roxanne, you've produced a lot of things. Was that always the plan to produce and then maybe eventually transition to directing? Or did that come out of a love of producing? And obviously your stuff is, you know, where did film come into the idea? Like, that's how I want to express my art with, you know, the stuff that I do. So for all three of you, where did kind of that transition where you knew you wanted to be a part of film come from?
Well, I was a visual effects artist for 5 years before I took the job offer at Remorgue. I had a very successful career working at CBC Television in Toronto. But then this opportunity was dropped in my lap to take over and run a horror magazine. And I thought, well, fuck, there's only two of them in the world. I want to be the woman running the other one, right? So I did it. And it was a great experience. And it was my university dissertation on the genre. I got to study it, like, in, you know, inside and out. And make a bunch of contacts. But even when I was doing visual effects, I wanted to make films. I just didn't go to film school. I took forensic anthropology in university instead. So I studied bones and, you know, and I realized I didn't want to spend my life teasing putrefied flesh off of bones in a lab somewhere. So I decided that conceptualized violence, there was a big difference for me. What happens on paper and what happens in real life.
Yeah.
And what happens in real life is just too much for me. That's what I like, maybe why I like horror. So when I started at Remorgue, I actually told the publisher, I only want to stay here for 5 years because I want to make films. And I ended up staying for like almost 7, but it was always a stepping stone.
Right.
Yeah. So I just didn't know how I was going to do it. And until I just figured out that one day you just have to quit your job and go do it. Like, you just have to go and make movies if you haven't gone to film school. You just have to start doing it. And I couldn't do both.
Right.
So, yeah, eventually I had to retire. Retire from print journalism. And now I'm an old lady trying to make movies.
I didn't go to film school either. I got a degree in like creative writing and theater, so jazz hands. After I graduated, actually while I was still in school, I started working at the Belcourt Theater in Nashville, which is kind of like CineFamily here in a way. It's an art house calendar theater. And that kind of was my film school because growing up, like I said, like I just had kind of basic cable to go off of and, you know, Dr. Giggles. Kind of was like
this.
Yeah.
Love Dr. Gill. Directed by Manny Cota.
And this is going to sound so ridiculous, but like one of the two theaters at the Belcourt, they have, you know, the screens that come down because they also have shows there. It's it was like the old Grand Ole Opry, one of the original Grand Ole Opry. And you can go behind the screen and you can see through the screen and you can watch people watching the movie. Ooh. So, like, a total creep, I would use whatever excuse I could while people were watching the movie to go and watch them unguardedly watching this movie like a total psycho. And that's when I knew I wanted to make movies, was watching how people were affected by cinema when they thought no one was watching. And that's kind of, I think, what led me into producing. Ultimately, I had met Brad Miska and was writing for him for some stuff while I was in grad school and started working for the parent company of his website doing like acquisitions and was on the entertainment business side. And we made VHS kind of in the middle of that, and that's kind of what started off the producing. And that kind of was born out of too just movie nights at friends' houses. Like I said, it was all just a bunch of friends making movies together. And I think a lot of anthologies are kind of more of a TV model where it's much more collaborative, creative process. And so that's kind of what led me from the producing side into the directing side. When Brad had come to me and said, I think I can get us financing to make another anthology or another kind of multi-director project, and the Radio Silence guys want to do it, if you want to do it. And I said, without even thinking about it, the first words that came out of my mouth were, only if I can direct. And wow. He was like, yes, of course. And wow. I was like, oh, well, shit, that was easy. I should have done that years ago.
Amazing. Yeah.
How did you feel? I'm curious because XX is like the inverse of the first VHS and I feel like it might have been a result of the same thing, not knowing what all the stories would be, but I remember the criticism laid out at the first VHS and especially always felt a little unfair on Bruckner's film because it's first, people would say, oh, it's misogynist. Mm-hmm. And I always felt, mm-hmm. no, Bruckner's is about misogyny, but it's yes. in an anthology surrounded by the same kind of story. Yeah. So it yeah. comes off as...
The whole thing that was fascinating about that was the connection of each of those pieces kind of became the male gaze.
Yeah.
And looking inward at that. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's always this thing that I find somewhat annoying in criticism where they look at a misogynistic character or misogynistic story makes the filmmaker themselves misogynistic. And I think that's unfair to storytelling, just in general.
If you're exploring an idea, like that first story is definitely exploring an idea.
Yeah, and those people exist. Those kind of people exist. And,
exactly.
Yeah, and the wraparound segment that Simon wrote was actually based on like real things that kids were doing in the UK and mm-hmm. videos that him and Adam had seen. That was like a phenomenon that was happening. So it's not like they just came up with that.
Well, and you see Larry Clark movies, right? And which was always behaviorally based. Those are things that they were witnessing. That's how mm-hmm. some teenagers were acting.
Yeah,
it's real stuff. But I do think I wonder if some of that criticism was just because they were all male directors and because their mm-hmm. their stories, because they weren't comparing their stories to see what other people are doing. It kind of you see a pattern, just like you do see a pattern.
Yeah.
In XX, I mean, there's three stories about children or family, you know.
Yeah. With the first VHS, we originally were trying to make a TV presentation, TV pilot. Mm. And then once we got into it, we were like, oh shit, we should just make a whole movie while we're at it. And it became VHS. So I think we, it was the first movie any of us, Brad and I had made as producers. So we were kind of making mistakes left and right and learning on the job. But I think that one compared to the second one feels like a little more punk rock and a little more like loose and kind of DIY, whereas the second one feels bigger but more put together. And we had all the filmmakers share their stuff earlier so that they could see what the other people were doing and kind of figure out the order together and that kind of stuff. And that's where that whole crew, TV model, I think, came together that we ended up using in Southbound, where we ended up actually having like a writer's room and coming up with the world and putting stories in it. So it's kind of like a weird evolution between those three movies.
I think it would be a neat idea to try for XX2, because this time we decided not to communicate at all, and I think it might be interesting to try to have a through line for the, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To just try telling one whole story and just giving one act or 20 minutes to one director, and, I think that mm-hmm. might be
interesting. Well, Southbound has, what I think in terms of anthologies, the best connection I've seen in any recent anthology between your film and David Bruckner's film. It's those two stories flow together so well that it may be other parts don't work as well in the film because that part's so good.
It's so smooth.
The connection of character and connection of story. So it doesn't need to be a big thing, but little threads are nice to carry.
Well, it's between his and mine, I feel like we made one film where ultimately he got to make the third act.
Right.
So that was kind of when I was approached to do XX and actually got to get onto the directing side of it after we finished Annie's section. I wanted to make something that was all third act.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I feel like I didn't quite get the just old school, fun, pulpy, oh shit, roller coaster kind of horror, which is what I really wanted to do with Don't Fall.
Right. And you did.
Yay!
And it's positioned in the right spot.
Yeah.
It has the right energy. It's good because Annie's is light and, provides a little bit of relief after mine, which is very depressing. And
what do you mean? It's Jack Ketchum.
Did you work with Jack Ketchum on transforming the script? And I know you had to change the protagonist from a male to a female. Did you have a lot of work with Jack on that?
I called him and because we're friends, and I talked to him and I asked for his permission to change the gender of the protagonist, and he said, of course, and basically we agreed that if you do that and your story falls apart, you probably don't have a very good story, right, in the first place. And, you know, that's what Ridley Scott did with Ellen Ripley. So we could do it, no problem. And really that was it. I added in an extra scene that I felt the story needed. I always felt like it was missing a Christmas dinner scene. And so I added in a very civilized Christmas dinner scene of them, you know, eating mommy with their knife and fork.
Which is funny because that's the moment where I knew I was watching a Jack Ketchum thing. Isn't that weird that it's coming from you and not him?
I know.
But that was the crystallizing image, I thought.
Yeah, I think that it plays really well. I toyed with shooting it in black and white because I really felt like it plays like a Twilight Zone or an old Night Gallery episode. And I toyed with the idea of actually shooting it in black and white. And so my biggest references were Night Gallery and Twilight Zone. But then the Christmas scene didn't work at all in that. So I just decided to, you know, pull back and just make it something my own, right?
Had you landed on another story prior, or was this one
I had
always?
Another story. It was too expensive. The idea was just not going to work. Just like Karen, her original story was about eating disorder, and her character is a person who is starving to death and like pretty much skeletal for the whole movie, and she just, you know, realized very quickly that she didn't have the resources to pull that off effectively. And I was worried about like taking 30 pounds off of Danny. So, I mean, I wrote it in such a way that, you know, there's a big leap from, you know, when we last see him to Christmas Day and then the hospital. So, you know, we didn't have to see him that much, but it was still an enormous amount of like rotoscoping, like an enormous amount of, like there's four rotoscope artists, like taking him out of every scene, making him thinner, sinking his eyes in, making his cheeks, you know, and then putting him back in the scene with the characters, and also painting the background, because once you cut a character out, you need to fill, right? And then put in a smaller version of them. So it was a huge amount of work, actually. A huge amount of visual effects work went into that. It was a combination of practical, like, cheekbones and visual effects. So.
Yeah, it was beautifully done, because I remember thinking, like, how did they do that? Yeah. Like, you were staring at him like, did they just build out with, you know, with actual prosthetics? Or it worked really well.
It's obvious. I mean, nobody's ever done that very well. I mean, I watched Thinner. It is not a good example.
See, that's something I saw when I was a kid it was terrifying to me as a kid that I'm like really scared to revisit because I feel like it's not going to hold up at all.
It does.
But like in my mind, the effects in that are amazing.
Welcome to our world every week.
11-year-old brain.
Every week we revisit things and every week we come in with a new disappointment. Yeah.
It's on Netflix now if you're feeling, you know, brazen.
The guy from RoboCop 3.
Yeah, RoboCop. Yeah, I mean, like, he's the guy that has to play RoboCop in RoboCop 3. He's like, you know, wearing a fat suit, and then,
I mean, the lizard guy is still kind of cool.
Corey Wurr.
So it was it was actually Lucky McGee that reminded me about the box. Because I had told him, I'd called him up and said, fuck, I don't have any cheap ideas. I don't know how I'm going to do this. Help me.
Right. That's honestly been my biggest problem. I feel like in getting anything made is that, like, I'll be like, oh, I have this idea. Here's and we do the script. And it's like, oh, no, nobody's going to give you money to make that. And they still consider it like a first feature.
They'll offer you so little and you just know you can't do it. And there's no way you can do a good job with that amount of money. And so you have to pass, right?
I feel like we keep making the same. There's only like a certain level of film you can make at some point with a certain amount of money, no matter how ingenious you try to get with like schedule and budget and resources.
Yeah, but look what you did with an RV. Look what you did with an RV in 3 days.
Yeah, we did that in 3 days.
That's amazing.
Our first day, like, so I do all my budgets as well, and like I was breaking this down, and I was like, oh, this is not going to be good with the schedule. And our first day, we shot all of Brita's stuff on the wall, all of the scene in the cave, and all of the daytime stuff. Mm. And that was like day one. And like I was looking at that schedule, and I was like, oh, we're so screwed. Come on, everybody, we can do this. You know, and you know, thank God we had Brita, who's just like amazing from Unreal. And I had cast Angela first, and she's, again, a friend of mine from, like, the comedy scene, known her for a while.
Trash
I wanted to work with her.
She's, yeah. She's so great.
Trash
yeah. Fire. I actually had talked to Ricky, you know, we always share each other's scripts, and he's a good friend of mine, and I had recommended her. I was like, you have to meet Angela Trimber.
She's hilarious in Final Girls. Yeah. I love her.
She's so funny. She's so funny just in general. And so I like to build around one actor and start casting from there. So she knew Brita and was like, you should really check her out for this. And I was like, yeah, that's a really good idea. I wonder if she'd be interested in this kind of horror thing. It doesn't seem like something she's really done before. And we sat down to talk about it. And it turns out that she has done all of this crazy, like, performance theater. She's like, well, there's this one time before I did this acting thing where I was a wolf for 2 years. And I was like, I'm sorry, come again? Can we just back up a little bit to the wolf years? And she was part of a performance troupe where they would go out in public and, like, perform as a wolf pack, like, moving through crowds and separating someone from the herd. She was like, we learned how to move in concert and move as a pack and all this stuff. So much of, like, the movement in my section with the creature is just stuff that she came up with that we would talk about, kind of like what I saw this creature coming from the earth and from this place and coming out as, like, kind of the protector, and how she envisioned that as, like, breaking away from the cliff face. Yeah, and then I hung her upside down on a rope for, like, 7 hours.
We should mention that Roxanne's is kind of a really neat creature feature.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this will be before it comes out, but we'll pimp it as much as possible. You know, the best compliment I could give, and this is pretty much halfway through Ivanka's segment, which is the first one in it, which is the Jack Ketchum box. You know, people always complain about – I mean, genre fans tend to complain about, oh, there's nothing original, there's no new stories to tell. And the thing I thought was interesting was there are, and there's not enough literary stuff. Like, Jack Ketchum, not enough of his work has been adapted. Like, there's so much stuff that's out there to be adapted still. There's so many original ideas. I thought yours was incredibly original. Roxanne, that's who I'm pointing to. So I don't know. I mean, do you agree? Because, you know, obviously all the filmmakers had to decide on their stories, but nobody knew exactly what anyone was doing. But I was taken aback by how strikingly original every single one of the stories was in it. And I feel like this is proof that we have barely scratched the surface in horror. It's not dead. It's not all about, you know, franchises and remakes. Like, there is still original stories to be told.
I think that it's all about new perspectives. And since, you know, over the last 100 years, 90% of all films have been made by men, the perspectives have been predominantly male in all genres. And it's not that women filmmakers tell stories in a different way. We just, you know, it's amazing. This tiny perspective shift feels so new all of a sudden, because, you know, we're telling stories about the mom just from a different perspective. And so I think, yeah, it's just the horror genre kind of lacks, you know, historically has lacked a woman's perspective. And that's just, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, Final Girls are great and stuff, but they're not real people. They're tropes. So I think the next great frontier is, in horror cinema is women, because you know, once we start depicting women as actual human beings, we start making feminist horror films. And before anyone gets their, like, briefs, boxer briefs, in a twist about the phrase feminist horror films, that all I mean by that is horror movies that depict women as actual human beings. Mm-hmm. And not tokens. And so that's what's starting to happen with these sort of, like,
these movies that are emerging.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see versions of ourselves on screen and not sort of paper thin tokens. It's a small movement, but I hope it continues. And, you know, I think that's the whole reason why we created this anthology, was to create opportunities for women, because it really is harder for us. And I'm not saying that because I'm like butthurt or something. It's just a matter of fact. You know, I mean, 7% of all working directors are women. And that's not because we're not interested in directing, and it's not because we're not interested in telling horror stories, because some of the earliest progenitors of the horror genre have been women. So here we are, and it's 2017.
One of the franchises that's just interesting that has most objectified women and used the male gaze and been all directed by men also fell apart today. And this makes me, with Friday 13th, it makes me think this would be a really interesting example to see a film that's literally built on the male gaze, like the way that narratives are created. And we talk about how they're more ritualistic films, that you don't even need a good story. You're just ritualistically reliving a point of view shot, basically, mm-hmm. of women. But what would happen now if
that's
we did get...
That's everything that Dario Argento makes, by the way.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Just more stylish.
Surreal, masturbatory vision of, like, you know... No, really. I mean...
But I'm curious what would happen. It would be interesting to see what that slight perspective... And it's not that slight. I feel like people are always dancing around gender difference or anything kind of difference, saying, oh, it's sometimes slight. Sometimes it's major. Sometimes the way people are looked at, I don't know what it's like to be walking down the street and everyone to be looking at me and looking into her. That's a very different psychological makeup. I don't think it's
baggage.
Minor.
There is a bunch of baggage that comes with it. And unfortunately, something like XX can't help but be politicized because it was born out of necessity, right?
Right.
If meritocracy had anything to do with women being hired for directing jobs, we would not have had to make a movie like XX. So it is what it is, but we look forward to – we made it because someday we look forward to no longer having to have our own lists. And, we look forward to just being I look forward to seeing my picture on that wall of all men in your lobby.
Yeah.
Yes.
right. Oh, I mean, yes. And I don't want to have a separate hallway with just women.
Right.
Yeah. I want to be in the same group as everyone else because I'm not a Canadian filmmaker. I'm not a woman filmmaker. I'm not a woman in horror. I'm just a person who tells stories.
You know, we talked very briefly about this before we went on air, but what did you guys learn from Karin? Because we had Karin on our previous podcast, and I mean she's the seasoned veteran in this business that has seen the ups and downs of it, and made one of the best films of last year. So
with real people.
Yeah, so what did mm-hmm. having her on board? What did you guys learn from Karin and her experiences? Because I think she's just a fascinating person and a fascinating filmmaker.
You know, we just met her.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Like, I had met her before. I met her at Fantastic Fest, literally on stage at the Fantastic Debates, and we were on the team that was literally, like, the men against the women team. And that was the first time I had met her, and I saw her section before we shot Annie's section. So, but I hadn't talked to her at all.
Yeah.
Or, we had, like, no kind of dealings with her during the process of that. But I always look at like her and people like Penelope Spheris is like, they kind of make one for them and one for themselves,
yes.
You know, one for like the studio and then one for them and one that's more personal. And that's always been something that I'm interested in, of like, you can ride both of those lines and you can do both of those things and live in both of those worlds. But I would love to hear more of her experience on both sides of that.
I did a whole press day with her yesterday, and so we got to know each other a little bit. And I mean, I wish she was here because she could speak to that barrier, this fucking chasm that exists, like for women in particular, where, anybody can make a movie for a small amount of money, their first feature. It's the second feature that women can't get made usually, right? It's that's this big... I can give you a ton of examples of I don't want to dwell too much on this part of it because ultimately we just want to tell horror stories, right? But it has to be said. But I can give you all these examples of like guy makes one short film, puts it on YouTube, and is making a $20 million movie next. I can give you exactly zero examples of how many times that have happened. That's happened to women, and it's just there's a lot of barriers, right? That are. We're denied networking opportunities. Women also, we don't network as well as men. That's something I'm trying to do more of. I'm trying to reach out to more women and help more women to try to make things better. And Karin can speak to how that going to director jail After, you know, making Aeon Flux and it not making enough money. And when women go to director jail, they stay there for a really long time. Guys can, you know, get out. What's the Colin Trevorrow, that guy that made that? Is that, what's his name?
Yeah, he made Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park. World, and it was apparently like, you know, an enormous flop. But I mean, he's fine, right? He was, you know, he's moving on, right? Well, that's harder for women.
Yeah. Well, I think the analogy is that it was a guy who just made like a micro budget movie, and now all of a sudden he's getting a.
Yeah, but this doesn't happen to women.
No, we don't get these offers.
And we're also not allowed to fail.
Right.
Women need to be allowed to fail.
It's very much like you're being held to a standard. And I hate, like, being the unicorn in the room is how I always feel like it. Whenever I'm in a room with other directors, it's always like you're the token female there. So it feels weird being the unicorn because everyone's holding you to the standard. Like, you have to hold up your entire gender behind you because of it.
I'm representing everyone. I mean, Roxanne actually is a unicorn.
But I didn't want to say anything. We've gotten a lot of that kind of with the press we've been doing this with movie of like, you kind of feel, especially after doing like a couple weeks of this, like you have this onus on you to have the answer to the question that like so many people have talked about for so long and don't have the answer to. And it's very frustrating as like a filmmaker because you're the person who has the answers, you know, who's like, no, this is the direction we're going. This is like, follow me. So not having that answer is very, very difficult, but also it's like, I don't want to speak for all women. Like, I wore a fucking onesie to our premiere last night. Like, if I'm the representative of all women, like, I apologize.
I'm pretty like, it sure doesn't you work. Made an outfit change in the middle of the show. Or I blinked.
It was a Masters of the Universe one? Is that what you were?
I saw Saturday morning cartoons. There was a lot on there because I saw Muppet Babies too.
Jem was on there. I had a snork on my crotch.
But Rebecca's right. Rebecca's very right because there's a sense that we are like, you know, we're responsible for our entire gender, making this movie. And the questions are absurd sometimes, you know, in the interviews.
I actually got asked about why, like, almost like in a, well, why wasn't yours about mothers? And it's like.
Actually, it is kind of.
In a symbolic way. Like, we get that. But like, is that the story I'm supposed to tell? Is like a, I don't know.
Yeah, that's weird.
Ivanka,
because men don't get asked questions like as a male director. Mm-hmm. Do you feel a responsibility to help other male directors break into the business? And what are you going to do to change everything about institutionalized sexism in the film business? Do you know what I mean?
The one that kills me the most.
Fuck, I don't know. I just want to make horror movies.
I bet you get this one too, Ivanka. The question that I get asked repeatedly whenever I do these women in horror panels or anything like that is, how do you balance motherhood and filmmaking? And I know you probably get this one too, Ivanka. And I'm like, no one fucking asks these guys how they balance fatherhood and filmmaking. Why is this like such a burden upon me that I need to even be weighing one against the other? It's not, I mean, there's nothing there. It's a pointless question. So, yeah, but I always get asked that one.
Gender essentialism and stuff like that. But that's really boring.
Yeah.
There have been directors who have smashed it before, but they're like very much alone. Like, I mean, looking at Bigelow's early work, you know, where she was making genre fare, and it seems like she had period right after, I think, Stranger Days, where you had that same problem where she made something that to me is like visionary. That film's like so out there. But it did land her in director jail for a while, and it took a long time to kind of reinvent. And then had she not won an Oscar, it probably took making something really
good. James Cameron.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, well, that's part of the networking, I guess.
She paid her dues. Yeah.
But that's also raw.
She's still had a big budget, though.
But it's raw, unapologetic talent, too, though. But what she made, though, why I think is interesting is she wasn't making stories about motherhood. You know what I mean? She was going point. Break, you know, is one of those movies that everyone on the fucking planet loves. Yeah. And it's all about masculinity and femininity and like role reversals. It's so much fun. I just think it's weird. She doesn't really weigh in on this very much. She has, I think, said one time, I just want to make movies.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're trying to all do, but you're kind of forced to also fight for that right to an extent.
I mean, she recently did acknowledge the gender problem, and she said that she admitted like the thing that we all know, that there is a really serious problem and there's no simple solution to it, right? And this was something actionable that we could do instead of just complaining or starting a blog or whatever. It was something actionable that we could do, and we could hire women. And I'm, you know, really proud of the fact that we had a lot of women on our crew, and there's one, a woman that I gave a chance to, who is now a union member and working full-time in film. And she sent me this amazing letter saying, you know, because of you, one more woman is working in film. And can I be done now? Can I just go and make horror movies and, like, not, not like have Annie this enormous responsibility on my shoulders? Absolutely. Like, this burden of, like...
I feel like Annie and I, for both of our stories, like, it never once was there a conversation about, like, well, how do we place this in the larger... political and sociological worldview of femininity, or like representative of whatever. Like, we're just like, what is going to be really scary or really funny and dumb?
Yeah.
One of those two things. Mm-hmm. And one thing I think we tried with hers too, since it is more of like a black comedy, like we, the score for that and the sound design for that is so over the top horror, like in the most mundane of situations, that kind of evokes what our main character is feeling, and it's so much in her perspective. But every time, like, we would have a big, like, scare or stings or anything, we would be like crying laughing because it's such a ludicrous thing to put on top of this very, like, suburban kind of austere environment. And that was like one of the big things that was so fun for us with that, in making it something that was like playing with the horror tropes. And I love that you see the stories themselves as original, because I feel like mine is very much a cookie cutter, like, these are the tropes. And I just wanted to play within that world with those tropes.
Right. Well, your title throws it off. Like, I had an expectation, don't fall, and a bunch of hikers going up in a mountain. I'm kind of like, And then when it kind of turned creature feature, I was like, oh, fuck yes. Yeah, like, yeah, I just want to see a monster. Mysteries. So, yeah, very cool.
All right. So it comes out February 17th.
Yeah.
VOD and select theaters.
Amazon Video, iTunes.
Excellent.
Nice.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Is it too early to talk about what's next? Have you started thinking about what's next, or you want to take a vacation from promoting this movie?
No. Well, I mean, if this movie does well, I'm sure that there'll be another sequel, and it'll be the same kind of idea where there'll be like some name and more experienced directors, and then a couple of slots for newcomers who are unable to get a break in any other way. And so, you know, hopefully if it does well, and it looks like it's going to do well.
Nice.
I've written a feature film of my own. It's not quite horror. It's a hyper-violent thriller about a woman who, with terminal brain cancer, who has to kill 5 people to save her own skin. And I've also been attached to direct a science fiction action film with kids, which is not a horror film, which I'm really excited about, because I was as surprised by this script as other people will be when they find out that I'm directing it. Because, yeah, it's not what people are expecting of me. And that's okay. So I'm excited about that. We have, you know, support from Telefilm, and looks like we'll probably be shooting it in Canada in the summer when the kids are all off school, because it's all young people. So,
I have 3 features and 2 TV shows.
Wow.
That I've been working on.
Why are you slacking?
I know. But mostly what that looks like is me in my pajamas with my cat and a laptop. So... and it's like, there's always so many things I feel like as a filmmaker you're working on.
Right.
But you're really just, it looks like you're just kind of watching cat videos, until there's financing behind it, and then it's a real thing. And it's not even like all through prep, it never feels like a real thing. It's not until like the day you're all on set that you're like, wait, you guys, are we really doing this? Is really happening right now? and that's like when it feels like, okay, we're doing it. It's happening. So until then,
do you still enjoy the act of producing, or has it changed?
Absolutely.
Okay.
No, it's such a creative, collaborative process for me. But I've also only ever worked with these anthology type projects that are very much in a TV model, where it does feel like more of a creative cross collaboration between writers, directors, producers across the board. So I don't actually know how that would be for a feature, producing a feature that doesn't have like 17 directors and all of us being like, oh, what if we did this?
And what about you, Sophia?
Wait, what's the TV show? What's the TV show? I mean, Jen Lynch and I are developing a TV series together.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's called Mother's Milk. And it's also women-oriented. And we are co-creating it together. And we'll probably be hiring all women writers and directors for the show if it lands at the right place. So I'm very curious about what you're doing.
Both of my TV shows are with Zane Grant. He's a really good friend of mine.
We know Zane.
Awesome writer. We saw him last night.
Yeah, he's great.
Great writer.
Yeah, he's really good. Yeah. And we have one called Inhabitants that's kind of like a Invasion of the Body Snatchers set in the teen high school world of like Winter's Bone, mm-hmm. I guess you would say. And then the other one is kind of about... these kids that are playing this kind of D&D-esque game in college and then start to realize that these modules that are being released are mirroring murders that are occurring in their small college town. So it's them trying to, like, figure out that mystery.
Neat.
Yeah.
I like it.
Super cool. And what about you, Sophia? What would you like to work on next besides catching up on all the horror classics?
Yes, big... homework.
Let's start with Child's Play. Give it another chance.
Yes. Well, I'm writing right now, mm-hmm. and I'm writing a film animated. It's a feature film animated. Is mm-hmm. that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is.
Yes.
So, in terms of animation, it takes maybe for fiction maybe it takes 1 year, but for animation it really takes like. 3 years, for example. Mm. So if I really want to do this feature animated film, it's going to take me my whole life. So I'm just breathing and writing and also just trying to move this faster, the faster that I can, because I live in Mexico. Mm. So we have another reality with budgets and, you know, this it's not that fast in Mexico, so it is. I'm trying to do this the quickest that I can. So, mm-hmm. yes.
What's this press tour been like for you? If you're not used to
no, this is crazy for me. I mean, I did go to the film school, and I remember that I had a class, and this class was about how impossible was going to be for me to make movie, and I just remember that I just went out of the classroom and I was just like, oh my God, and I'm just really doing this. So if I go backwards and I'm just, come on, just looking at me, at myself right now, it's like really crazy. And it's like a, whoa, dream or something. And it's been absolutely amazing just to be attached to this project and anthology. It is crazy. Yes.
And again, if you want to know the secret kind of like of every single one of the pieces, like her interstitials kind of just tell you everything you need to know before you see them.
That's why I want to see it again.
Yeah.
So I could pick those up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, excellent. Thank you. Thank you all so much for
giving us your time.
Really appreciate it. XX is out February 17th, limited theatrical, VOD. Yep. Definitely check it out.